Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to be talking about the Republican weapon, the weapon of systematically defunding and dismantling our nation. Well, it continues, the weapon of defunding. Yes, defunding education, defunding health care, defunding off defund Obamacare. Tonight we're going to talk about a bold new initiative being proposed at Clarion University. Yes, defunding it and firing people. That's the Republican way. And then maybe we can get Sherman Reed to go over there with his little poverty tour and look at the people who lost their jobs. And bad decision getting into higher education. Should have done that. Also, more on people. More on people with guns. A priest looking for his 15 minutes of fame. And, of course, a dead 12-year-old, thanks to an AR-15. Also making Pennsylvania the Texas of the Northeast, or more like it, making Texas the Pennsylvania of the Southwest. We'll talk about infrastructure and what's not being done. Last night we talked about Texas. They're going to be transforming this, some of their roads into gravel roads because they don't have the funding to continue to pave them. So they're going to make them gravel roads. There's an idea maybe the Corbett administration will come out. Maybe we could just make 81 here a gravel road. Drop the speed limit down to 30. Want to see gridlock then? Beautiful. Also, we're going to talk to some folks fighting for a fair shake as banksters are still screwing homeowners. We'll talk to a homeowner fighting back and to hear how the community there is backing him. Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7424. You can email me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com. So with school starting, my kids, a couple, Monday's the big day already. I mean, summer, this summer just, I have no idea where it went. It just blew right by. My wife and I were talking about this yesterday as we're going, where did it go? Now, granted, we were on the road for an entire month. We drove 9,600 miles cross country on our labor history tour, which you can still look at some of the photos and some of the stuff there at peoplestourforamerica.com. The kids, what's amazing is, my kids, you would think, tired of driving, tired of traveling. No, want to do it again. Actually, can we do it again before school starts, Dad? No. We have driven quite enough. Thank you very much. But the summer is coming to an end. School is about to start. And, one of the things that I hope for is that while they're going to school, they get a good quality education. They're exposed to a lot of things, a lot of opportunities, a lot of new information, maybe twisted and contorted a little bit to think outside the box, maybe even challenge some of the things that I am teaching them so that we have a give and take and we have a process where they learn to be their own human beings. And I got to be honest, part of this whole push towards destroying public education is to destroy that component of it. There's a segment of our population who believes that they've reproduced these little mini-me's. And my kids are going to believe exactly what I believe, and they're never going to challenge me. Good luck on that one. I want critical thinking kids who are in the future going to make decisions that are going to be the best for the country and at some point hopefully think about me along the way. Just a thought. But I came across this story from Milwaukee, Wisconsin that should scare every person who believes that this charter thing, the cyber charters and the Hammurabi charter school or the Frontier Virtual Cyber Charter School or all of these fly-by-night newfangled schools. It just popped up because someone got an idea. Oh, let's be entrepreneurial and start ourselves a school. Well, the school in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Career Academy, an MPS charter school. The parents thought, what a great fit. Oh, it would be fantastic. We'll send our daughter Amanda there. She enrolled. She attended 4 years of high school, graduated, got her diploma. And then, decided, hey, going to work for a little bit before I go on to college. I get a little, just a little bit of, a background, earn a little bit of money so I can pay my way through because college is expensive. So she graduated in 2009. Now here it is, you know, 4 years later, decides, you know, I need to go to college. I'm going to college. She signs up to go to the Milwaukee Career College. Problem is, the admissions director told her that she would be more than welcome to come to the Milwaukee Career College if she only had a GED. Turns out, her charter school wasn't accredited. What can you say? And, you know, you go through this and you go, well, hold on. Let me think this through. But wasn't this a school, you know, put forth by the state, by the, you know, school, local school district? Well, didn't matter. According to the Milwaukee Career College, Amanda's diploma, no good. And, you know, this is what happens. This is the kind of stuff that you end up with when you play these games. And I've been saying for, I guess, what now, 5 years on this program, that what's going to happen to public education, that K-12 public education, is exactly what's going on in the higher ed world, where you've got a bunch of these for-profit entrepreneurial colleges that are, you know, we're gonna cater to the need of the student. Problem is the credits that you earn at a number of these institutions, they transfer nowhere. And, you know, I've known a number of people over the years who go, well, I went to this, you know, this online college, and you know, I earned, you know, 20 credits paid through the nose for them, but nobody will take them. So I'd like to transfer to the local community college. And there's something wrong with the idea that you've paid like $500 a credit hour for one of these online classes at some, you know, this such and such is for profit, you know, really nice brochures, but not so much on the education. Something wrong with the idea that you're going to pay $500 for a credit hour at some, you know, for profit thing, but your local community college won't take it. Where they're charging you probably about $80 or $90 per credit hour. I think it's up to $100 now. But, I mean, the point is you look at this and you go, there's something seriously wrong. Where did that money go? Oh, yeah, the CEOs and the shareholders. But what they've done to higher ed, and they've been doing this for a number of years now, they're going to be doing the K-12. And, you know, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, with the woman who's running for mayor in New York City wanting to give out loans for middle-class parents, you know, people making between $80,000 and $200,000, giving low-interest loans to those folks so that they could send their kids to, you know, a good pre-K program. Because, you know, we need to make sure that they have the leg up by taking out loans and saddling their four-year-old with debt. I mean, and I've been saying, look, mark it on the calendar, because I believe at some point it's going to happen. If the right wing in this country gets its way, if Wall Street gets its way, if the Americans for Prosperity and all the tinky tank think tanks get their way, you're going to be paying through the nose for an education, or you're going to be warehoused in what's left, the remnants of what was an amazing public school system. The crumbled remains of what was a mighty education system, because they will have defunded and defiled and destroyed and dismantled it. And you look at what's going on in Philadelphia right now. They have set up, honestly and truthfully, the Republicans in this state, with the help of a large number of Democrats, they have set up what is the perfect storm. They have set up the perfect destructive storm. They have, one, they defunded it. Two, hey, let's privatize it. Hey, let's try another newfangled thing. Hey, let's take it out of local control and put it into the hands of dictators. Oh, hey, let's try something different. One of the things I agree with the Republicans in Congress on, people need certainty. There needs to be some consistency. Now, while I understand the Republicans in Congress are consistently the party of no, consistently the party of we're not going to invest in infrastructure, no, we're not going to invest in our children, no, we're not going to invest in our country, but we'll build bombs. While they've been consistently the party of no, they're right. Consistency is important. So if you have a school district that's consistently underfunded, If you have a school district that is consistently changing, where you have a consistent turnover, where you're consistently introducing new things that cost more of the divided pot, and you have a funding scheme like we have in Pennsylvania that screws Philadelphia more than anybody else, you're going to have problems. And what I find really interesting is that $304 million, the superintendent said that the school district was shorted in Philadelphia. And amazingly enough, $305 million go to charter schools. Is it me, or does that just seem like too much of a coincidence? But here's the thing. We can't talk about that. And the reformers who say we want to fix public education while profiting from it, of course, they're all upset because, well, there's too much coincidence for them, so they've got to point somewhere else. And the somewhere else in this are the teachers. The assault is, well, the assault has been for a couple of years now square on the back of the teachers. But right now, this defunding of the Philadelphia schools, Corbett has put right on the back of the teachers, saying, you know, okay, we'll give you $45 million, but you've got to screw those teachers out of $133 million. Take it out of their lunch money. Take it out of their supply money. Screw them however you can. And I look at this story by the PA Independent, a shill group, who's had the big headline. It was over at Philly.com. A Philly school funding crisis driven by pensions, and it's only going to get worse. They go in to say that the school district's scrambling to come up with enough cash to open up the doors in September. But according to a new report, the city's school's funding crisis, well, could be as bad as Detroit and Chicago and everywhere else. And what's the problem? It's the pensions. It's those teachers. It's those retired teachers. In fact, according to a right-wing shill front group, the Thomas Fordham Institute, they estimate that, you know, the debt from these retirement costs, these benefits, gonna go from $73 million to $349 million by 2020. That's gonna work out to be $900 per pupil in 2011 and as high as $2,300 per pupil in 2012. Let me be the first to say that that's really just an idiotic assessment. The per pupil thing, that's assuming that the teacher is going to teach one kid and then retire. Okay, yeah, I taught my kid. Do I get my $2,300 now? It's ludicrous, isn't it? But it's meant to grab your attention and go, oh my goodness. Not that these teachers teach thousands of kids throughout their careers. No, don't worry about that. Don't look behind the thing. Don't look behind the curtain that the Philadelphia school district teachers, that they make upwards of 20% less than the teachers in surrounding areas, because it's a struggling district, because it's defunded, because the state has a screwed up funding mechanism. Don't worry about that. Blame those pensions, those benefits. And I love that, because they frame it in benefits. They're not benefits. It's money that the teachers have said, okay, we're not going to take in wages because we want to retire at some point, and we want you to administer the program. And you, the state, should have been putting in your share of the compensation. Because understand, the portion the state was supposed to be putting in is part of the compensation. And I think the teachers should be filing suit saying, we got screwed out of wages. They cheated. This should be a wage theft case. And in fact, every penny that the state didn't put in to the fund, every dime they didn't put, if I were the teachers, I'd be suing them. But understand, this is all of this is to get us to go, oh yeah, the schools are in big trouble, and it's those teachers. Understand, the game here, the end result of all of this, is what the wealth class in this country and the Republican string pullers want. They want to destroy public education. Bottom line. They want to privatize and profitize it. It's that simple. Doesn't get any simpler than that. And the fact that they're not going to open the doors until the teachers surrender another $133 million in cuts only highlights the fact that they want to destroy public education. Because how many of those teachers can then afford to stay? Not that they haven't been doing their best to fire a lot of them. What was another 650 were fired this past June? Over 20,000 education professionals in this state out of work because of this governor? Because we need to give tax breaks to big corporations. And kayak trips. And the house in South Carolina. It's insane. Let's take a quick break. When we come back and talk a little bit about what's going on at Clarion University with higher ed, you're going to want to stick around for this. Quick break, right back. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. God bless all.
Don't let us get stupid, all right. Just make us be brave. Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. About 250 people returned to Wisconsin's Capitol Rotunda Monday singing their daily noon hour protest songs as Capitol Police arrested more people.
I have a First Amendment right
stay
to be
back.
Here to report
stay
this. I
stay
back. Do what I'm doing. I am not interfering with you.
Stay back.
Take
sir.
Your hands
You're
off me. We are free still. Anything to say about the arrest?
The right of the people peaceably to assemble, to consult for the common good, and to petition their government or any department thereof shall never be abridged. This officer arresting me right now is violating the Constitution he was sworn to protect.
Out of the way, please!
Madison Police Detective Brian Austin joined the Solidarity Sing-Along on Monday. Austin protested as part of Cops for Labor during the Wisconsin uprising of 2011.
Kind of the last straw for me when I'm seeing journalists and our elected representatives and children arrested. This just has to stop. This is the United States of America. Our First Amendment rights are what make us Americans.
Active and retired firefighters in their fire hats, like Rory Board, also stood shoulder to shoulder with the Solidarity Sing-Along. Board urges more union members to join the Solidarity Sing-Along.
They ought to come up here and sing, is one thing they ought to do. Be seen and voice their opposition to this illegal shutdown on human rights, on our constitutional rights. First Amendment rights, the freedom of speech. It does not need a permit. That's why we're here.
Ordered by Scott Walker's administration to arrest peacefully assembled singers, the cops have also arrested journalists. They shoved at least one reporter today as the reporter tried to record the arrests. Marty Beal is head of the Wisconsin State Employees Union, affiliated with AFSCME. He's urging unions and others to send more people to the Capitol to uphold First Amendment rights.
We've seen the crowds grow here, and the crowds need to continue to grow because, as I said in my piece, is that this is the last remnant of what Walker hasn't been able to take away from working men and women. So we need to preserve this. This is ours. This is in our house. Now's the time. Now's the time.
Two people arrested for singing continued to sing as they were led away in handcuffs for singing protest songs in Wisconsin's Capitol Rotunda. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I'm proposing something we haven't had in a long time, a reality-based budget.
Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So it was today, back in 1964, President Lyndon Baines Johnson, as part of his Great Society, signed the Economic Opportunity Act, which established the Head Start program. And, you know, I go and I think about this, and you think about all of the assaults, all of the attacks that have gone on just in the last couple of years, thanks to our governor. But, you know, throughout my whole life, the attack on the Great Society and all of the programs that, I got to be honest, as a kid I benefited from it, and a lot of the people I knew did. that help people achieve the middle class, like helping kids get an education. You know, as someone like me growing up in the projects in Cleveland, you know, that opportunity to get that education, to move into the middle class and to get into college, that's how we grow our economy. That's how we grow our country, not by handing out more tax breaks to big corporations, and certainly not by firing teachers, which is why I've asked Professor Elizabeth McDaniel. She is the chair of the English department at Clarion University. She's also a chapter president with APSCUF. Dr. McDaniel, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, well, thank you for your interest.
You know, I look at this, and I saw the report that there was this bold, ambitious workforce plan going on at Clarion University. It was revolutionary.
Oh, yes.
I guess to fire 40 people.
Oh, of course. You know, what's revolutionary about that and bold?
Well, nothing. But, you know, it's how you sell it, I guess. When you're bringing bad policy, it's all in the presentation, right?
That's right, yeah.
We're giving those 40 people a new opportunity, a second chance at poverty, I guess.
I guess so. And the Clarion borough and the entire county has an extremely high unemployment rate, and this is just going to be another nail in the coffin, perhaps.
Yeah, I know. I've seen, you know, this kind of thing going on at a number of the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education schools, East Stroudsburg, Kutztown. There have been a number of these. We need to slash these people.
Right.
Education,
right.
You know, and I go back to the guy who was the chancellor, and I don't know what you think of the new guy, but the old guy evidently had this transformation plan.
Yes, he did. It was just a lovely plan.
And what was the transformation that he was attempting to pursue?
Well, he wanted to, as far as I could tell, he wanted to completely change the way we deliver education. Let's look at the University of Phoenix for a model, for example. And instead of thinking in terms of universities and having open access and helping people better themselves, it was, you know, he wanted to, well, actually, we kind of thought that he was, you know, he should have gone to the store and gotten himself a Transformer toy. And that would be more useful.
He could play with his toy.
Right.
No, but, you know, I look at this, and right from the very beginning, you have to ask the question, what is it that the Pashy schools are supposed to do? Are they educating kids, or are they for profit?
I know. Everything at Clarion now is, the bottom line is money. It's money, money. It's how many butts can you get in your seat in your class? How many students can you get? You know, not about what kind of an education are we providing to our students, what kinds of opportunities, but it's money, money, money. How much are you costing? In fact, I was told by an administrator a couple of months ago that Clarion has one of the oldest faculties in the state system. And I said,
that's good, right? Experience.
That's good. That means that we're experienced. That means that, you know, we have all of these years of teaching and research and service to bring to our students and energize them and send them off into the world fully prepared to face whatever. But the bottom line is, to this administrator, it's bad because we're expensive.
Oh, okay, because I thought you were going to say that, you know, you weren't hip enough. Maybe you could wear some bling and maybe some skinny jeans or something. Maybe that's
know,
where he was going.
I hadn't thought about it that way, you know.
But he's just going, you're just too expensive. You old people, it cost me too much. You got to go. That's the quality of your teaching and the product that the kids are getting, the education, that's not important. It's bottom line bean counter stuff is what you're telling me.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's bean counter stuff. In fact, I suspect that part of what's behind the identification of some of these programs retrenchment of faculty has to do with trying to prod older faculty who may be eligible to retire but don't want to retire. They want to continue teaching. Push them into saying, okay, I'll take the knife, I'll retire before I'm ready to save a colleague's job. And to me, that is highly unethical, if not immoral. It's the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, I'm with you. Retrenchment, that's just a fancy word of saying for fire, dumping people, right?
Exactly.
We used to speak in simple language. Retrenchment means, in my view, when I see that, I go, well, you're firing somebody.
Yeah.
It's like eliminating redundancies. You're firing somebody.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's what you're doing, and that's what the plan is. And when the administrators talk to the press or they send out their PR pieces that are spinning this, they never talk about the fact that they are cutting people's jobs, that they are changing and destroying people's lives. They never mention that. In fact, some of the PR pieces they've sent out don't even mention the fact that this grand vision, this grand plan of theirs, eliminates people.
Well, I mean, you can retire because you have that golden parachute pension, right?
Oh, of course. Of course.
I mean, isn't that what we're told? I mean, you know, I was just talking a minute ago about the Philadelphia School District and you know, the Shill News Group, PA Independent. Mm-hmm. They said the whole reason that the school is in trouble is because those teachers have pensions.
That's bull.
Well, you and I know that.
Yeah,
but
I know,
the sad reality is the message that people are getting are going, wow, those teachers have pensions, and mm-hmm. wow, I don't.
Yeah, so why should they get it if I don't have it?
Exactly. And I mean, the reality is the education process that goes in this to explain that, you know, those pensions are deferred compensation. Those teachers said, don't give me a raise now. Put it into a pension fund so that I can retire at some point when I get older.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to be a message we've got to tell. And I've been saying that what I think should happen is the teachers' unions and the teachers should be suing the state for wage theft for all the years they didn't put money into the pension funds.
Oh, I agree. Absolutely. And the reason there is the pension problem now is because they didn't put the money in when they were supposed to. And lo and behold, the stock market crashed. You know, there are economic problems. And, oh, no, the money that we thought we had that was extra is now gone.
Yep. Thank you, George Bush. But, you know, here's the thing that happens with my fear of what's going on right now with the Pashy schools, the state-owned universities, which I think are the gem of our state, something that I think other areas look to us with envy of. And, in fact, you know, I think it was Dow Chemical moved a plant down near Philadelphia, and they said the reason that they chose Pennsylvania was because of the education system, the higher education system. And I think, you know, Clarion is part of that, you know, part of the 14 state-run universities. But what bothers me is there's this business-friendly mentality.
Right.
That it's not so much about serving the kids. It's not so much about, you know, their critical thinking skills and their exploration and growth. It's about what are we churning out? What kind of workers are we churning out of there? That's my fear in this.
Exactly. And, I mean, it's as if we're widgets. You know, and we're working in a widget factory and we're producing widgets. You know, the business model doesn't fit with education because it's a collaborative experience with the faculty member, the student, the other students in the class, all of us working together to explore a particular topic, whatever the subject might be. And also, I think that it is highly unethical of universities to accept students, to go out and recruit and accept students who are not as well prepared to do the college-level work that they should. And it is our obligation, I believe, to provide the services and the tutoring and the assistance that these students need so that they can be successful. It's an implicit contract. We accept you into our university. Therefore, we believe you have the possibility, that you have the ability, that you can make it. Whereas Clarion is eliminating its department that provides those services. Academic enrichment. It's the tutoring center. It's special services for students with disabilities. It's students who are first generation and may not have had the preparation that they could have had in or should have had in the high school because we know the problems with K-12 funding.
Hold on. Let me get this straight.
Okay.
Because, you know, we hear an awful lot of the for-profits, the, you know, the ones that have CEO salaries in the tens and hundreds of millions of dollars. We understand that they're churning people out and they've got a pathetic graduation rate.
Right.
If they even have one. I get them doing it, but if I got this right, you're eliminating the ability to help kids move forward who may struggle, eliminating the tutoring, the learning labs and that stuff, so that if, you know, maybe you can't cut it right at the beginning, you're struggling, because, hey, it's a huge adjustment.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
They're cutting that, so basically you guys are going to be churning people like the for-profits are doing that.
That's our fear here. That is the fear of the faculty here, because how are you going to provide the services that these kids need to be successful if you eliminate the faculty and the department where people have the training and work one-on-one with these kids, where they make sure that there are qualified tutors assisting students who might be struggling in a math class or a biology class. They're eliminating it. They're getting rid of the 3 staff people and 5 of the 6 faculty members who work in there.
Now, is this a done deal? Is this already gone? I mean, this is we've already had the funeral for this, or is this something that can be fought against? And what are you guys doing to mobilize to save it?
Okay, well, what we're doing is we're actually there are some Facebook pages, and we're getting students and alums to post things, to write letters to the president and the provost and to protest against this plan. However, last Thursday when I first found out about this, the president herself, she's calling for comments. She wants feedback from people. And so one of the faculty members at this meeting said, "What kinds of comments do you want?"
I got a comment. Are you insane?
I know. And those aren't the kinds of comments that she wants. She said, "Well, if I have the name of a department wrong, or if some of the numbers are wrong, please tell me that, because we don't want the product to be wrong." She said, "But if you're asking if this plan will change," even though they call it proposed, she said, it's 95% to 98% a done deal.
That's one of my favorite ways of negotiating with people. Mm-hmm. They tell you, "Well, we're open to discussing it, but take a deep breath and hold, because it's not going to change."
Yeah. Well, I think that what's happening is they want to have the illusion of listening to people, but they already know what they want to do. So we're going to fight it.
We're going to fight
it tooth and nail here. We're going to try to save every single one of these faculty jobs, plus the AFSCME jobs and the SCUPA jobs, because we don't believe it has to be done. We believe that there are other ways that they could take care of the deficit, and what they are proposing to do is counterproductive.
I've got a way that they can put the money back in the budget. Stop giving out huge tax breaks to these huge corporations. Stop that already. That's a way to start, in my view, immediately, if not sooner.
Exactly. And so we're making plans about kind of in-your-face sorts of things, so that the president and the provost and the other administrators aren't able to just hide behind their rhetoric, hide behind using the word position, when it's not a position they're eliminating. It's a person's job. It's a person's life.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Dr. McDaniel. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, I think the students have got to be the integral part of this, because at a certain point, it affects them, but eventually it could be them, because I would assume a lot of them are going to want to turn around and maybe, come back and work at the university that they graduate from. I know a lot of people who have done that. At some point, doesn't this affect them probably more than you?
Absolutely. I mean, we're talking about their futures and the futures of their children. I mean, this university draws a lot from this region, the Northwest, and it's an area with, that's seen a lot of jobs disappear. And so one thing that parents want to do, they want their kids to improve their social economic status, all of those things. And you do that by going to school and by having a university that's truly a university, not a factory that's churning out people.
Out little worker bees.
Yeah.
George Carlin always said, just smart enough to push the buttons, but not smart enough to ask why.
Yes, exactly. And that's what we fear. I mean, the faculty are seriously concerned about what's going to happen to Clarion. And, of course, multiply this grand plan that the administrators at Clarion have. Think about the other state system schools. You know, there are 7 other state system schools living under the threat of retrenchment right now.
Yeah.
And if it's as massive as this one, which is the largest ever, in the state history of the state system, you know, my God, what are we going to be left with?
Now, if you want to send the Clarion University President and Whitney a message, there's a move-on petition that we've got linked at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Dr. Manuel's name. It'll take you right there, give you the opportunity to weigh in and tell the president of Clarion University your thoughts. The last question I've got for you, you know, in looking at this, how much of this is the Corbett administration? In your view, how much is their systematic defunding and dismantling of really all state assets in favor of privatization and in favor of handing out big money to the profiteers?
I think a lot of it has to do with that. There has been a significantly decreasing amount of money that is being provided for these universities, these state-owned, you know, we own these universities.
For now.
Yeah. and you know, the defunding of these, along with the defunding of K-12. I mean, it's an assault on public education in this state, I believe.
Yeah, it's the assault on everything that's public, everything that belongs to we the people. And
absolutely.
Not just here in Pennsylvania, but across the country as the Kochs and the rest of the folks who occupy our corner boardrooms and the corner offices there on Wall Street, they want it all, and they want it, well, now.
Yep, and they believe that we're just going to passively sit back and say, oh, do it to us. Can you step on me again?
Or, as I say, can you trickle on me a little more?
Exactly.
I've been trickled down upon. But if you want to sign in, of course, the petition over at Move On to tell President Whitney your thoughts, we've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Dr. McDaniel's name. It'll take you right there. Dr. McDaniel, it was great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed this conversation.
We'd love to have you back.
Okay, great.
Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the talk.
Beat up cars, tires, and drummers go. Crack, boom, bam.
Blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Suppose we were about to vote in an election that could drastically change American government from a democratic republic to a privately owned entity run by billionaires. Actually, such a plutocratic concept is not as far-fetched today as it would have sounded 25 years ago, but still, if it was put to a vote, the American people would soundly reject it. But now, let's suppose that the plutocrats, realizing that their privatization scheme was going to lose, suddenly and arbitrarily postponed Election Day so they could have more time to run deceitful campaign ads and woo special voting blocks with promises of money. And suppose they postponed the vote two more times, while also rigging the election rules to jack up their vote count. One more thing. Suppose they install their own judges to rule that all this manipulation is permissible. Preposterous, you say? Can't happen in America. Well, it's happening right now. Not in a political election, but in an ongoing vote involving corporate governance. And it demonstrates the utter contempt that moneyed elites have for any rules, even their own, that get in their way of maintaining control. The chief autocrat in this real-life melodrama is Michael Dell, the multi-billionaire founder of the now-foundering Dell Computer Corporation. He recently got his hand-picked board of directors to let him and a few other financial elites turn the publicly traded giant into their private entity, In essence, they intended to seize Dell Inc. from its owners, i.e. shareholders, by using a razzle-dazzle line of hokum to cover up the fact that they were buying them out on the cheap, and even using the shareholders' own money to engineer the plutocratic coup. This is Jim Hightower saying, however, there's one group the Dell gang had not planned for. Angry shareholders. From a billionaire owner to just plain folks who are getting ripped off, a rebellion has erupted. I'll tell you more about the stacking of this corporate election in our next broadcast.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy, The Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Our quote of the day comes from Gary Young in his piece, The Misremembering of I Have a Dream, printed over at Nation. He says, if nobody dreamed of a better world, what would there be to wake up to? And, you know, I think about that. You know, I've been thinking about that question. You know, if you couldn't dream about doing better, if you couldn't dream about, you know, working harder and moving forward, why would you bother waking up? Or if you're a Republican, if you can't steal from someone, or if you can't, make more poor people, what would be the point of getting up? You know, if your policy can't hurt people, what's the point of making policy? I look at the screw question, which is now, you know, I remember all of the, well, it's just a little bit. It's not going to hurt anybody. It's just a little cut down. Right around, nobody's going to notice a thing. Turns out more than 2,000 people who live in Vermont, 774 households are going to be homeless in the next few months because of the cuts to Section 8 funding. In fact, Screwquester is cutting more than $2 billion in low-income housing assistance this year alone. The funding has basically fallen off the edge. And you're looking at, just in Vermont, 774 households potentially to the curb. Across the nation, you're looking at more than 140,000 families who could be left out in the cold. And, you know, I just saw this story not too long ago that caught my eye. It was one of those things that just makes you go, explain this to me, because I'm not getting it. There's a city in South Carolina, Columbia, South Carolina. I wonder if that's anywhere near Tom Corbett's new vacation home, the one that he forgot to, or didn't know, I shouldn't say forgot, he didn't know as the former attorney general. He didn't know he should have he should have disclosed that. Didn't know. The form was just confusing to the former attorney general. Anyway, Columbia, South Carolina. They're in the process of, according to the last report last week, their city council, unanimously approved this emergency homeless response plan. And basically what the emergency response plan is kick homeless people out of the city. We're just going to relocate them somewhere else. Exile them. You know, get rid of them. According to the report, there are about 1,518 people in the Columbia area who, well, either you leave or you get arrested, or we'll drive you to a faraway shelter that, you know, we can just dump you. Nice. But this is what Screwquester has done. This is what Screwquester has left communities doing. And these 140,000 families, I'm sure some of them in South Carolina, I'm sure some of them here in Pennsylvania, they're going to be faced with this kind of decision. And it's just not, it's just not Section 8. I mean, it's Meals on Wheels, so the elderly are going to get the shaft. It's cuts to Head Start. What is it, 57,000, almost 58,000 kids cut off the program. And you look at all of this, it's, you know, hey, you know, it's just a little around the edges. It's not a big deal. How many thousands of jobs have been lost? Actually, how many millions of jobs are going to be lost because of this? From the people who tell us that they care about the economy. And you've got a Republican in this state running around having a poverty. Oh, we're going to have a poverty tour. Yay, poverty tour. Yeah, we care. We care. Nonsense. You look at the assaults on us. I don't see any of these folks saying, you know what? We need to take a look at Pennsylvania's regressive tax code. Because in this state, the more money you make, the less taxes you pay. how do you figure that? How does that work? It just is what it is. It's the way of the world, Mr. Smith. You need to come around to the ways of the new world. Up is down, front is back. Rich people pay no taxes. You poor people, you pay a much higher tax. Just how it is. Pay your own freights. Get in the game. Isn't that what they keep telling us? It's mind-blowing. And I look at this story from New Jersey, because the big race for a Senate over in New Jersey is kind of heating up now that the Democrats have a candidate, Cory Booker, who I'm not fond of. But if I were a New Jersey resident, I would have to pull the lever because, well, he may be bad. This guy, much worse. He is Steve Lonergan, Republican, former state director for New Jersey, at the Koch Brothers Americans for Prosperity, where I believe last year made almost $230,000 as a shill for the Koch Brothers. He's been around, running around saying, you know, like a lot of the conservatives, and this is nothing new. This is nothing new with the hypocritical nonsense that we hear come from the GOP. We need to have no debt. We need to balance our budgets. We need, you know, you've heard it. We're not raising the debt ceiling. We're going to freeze spending, no new debt, you know, all of that. If you looked at his personal financial disclosure forms, which I did, turns out, Republican candidate Lonergan, he has somewhere between $1.5 and $6 million in mortgage debt. And I say $1.5 to $6 million because he has two separate mortgages. One between $500,000 and $1 million and another between $1 million and $5 million. So not sure where on the sliding scale. So he could have as little as $1.5 million, but as much as $6 million. And now look, I'm not saying anything about people having mortgage debt. You got mortgage debt. Most people do. My problem is saying that you can't incur any debt because it's bad. But you made $229,000, almost $230,000, and you're almost $6 million in debt. How many times is that your income? Just, you know, think that through. 10 times? 100 times? 200 times? I mean, think about it for a second. 300 times? And then look at our federal debt. Around 70, you know, around 72% of our GDP, which I got to be honest, I'd like to see lower. But to have someone like Lonergan, you know, continually preaching that, well, we need that, keeping people stupid, bothers me because it's hypocritical. Absolutely hypocritical. How many people remember? You want to talk about? This is one of those things that catches my attention often, and it's one of those things that infuriates me. I think I mentioned this the other day, that a state worker at the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources up at the Bald Eagle State Forest in Union County, evidently she misappropriated $15,000 in funds, you know, because I guess people pay for wood and for stone. I guess you can, you know, you could buy like a cord of wood for like $15. I think a ton of stone for a couple of bucks. Well, she borrowed, misappropriated. She stole it. She stole about $15,000. And I guess she used the state credit card a couple of times. You know, she's been arrested. You know, she's probably going to go to jail. It's going to happen. Suspended from her job, all that stuff. She's going to probably go to jail. There's, in my view, no question about it. I look at this story over at USA Today. And the headline read, SEC orders hedge fund manager to pay $18 million. The story reads, Today, billionaire hedge fund manager Philip Falcone and his advisory company will pay more than $18 million and admit wrongdoing in a settlement with the Securities and Exchange Commission over his use of fund assets to pay personal expenses and other costs. Let me ask a quick question. The woman who worked for the Bald Eagle State Forest, she took $15,000 in money, which is wrong. Staff, go to jail. I'm with you. Okay, I get it. She took $15,000. She's going to jail. There's no question about it. He took $113 million. $113 million, according to the SEC. Their allegation in 2012 that he improperly used $113 million to pay his personal taxes, secretly favored redemption requests by some hedge fund managers at the expense of others, and conducted an improper short squeeze in bonds issued by a Canadian manufacturing company. So how many people were harmed? Now, look, I understand. The woman stole $15,000. She needs to be held accountable, needs to be punished. With you. Got it. This guy misappropriated $113 million. How many people got hurt because... You know, I asked the question, you know, up at the little Bald Eagle place, how many people got hurt by that? I would argue probably not an awful lot. Still needs to be punished. This guy, $113 million, how much of that is, you know, folks' personal retirement stuff, maybe? He agreed to pay $18 million, him and his company, $18 million. And they had to admit wrongdoing, which is, I got to be honest, is a huge thing. The fact that they had to admit wrongdoing in this is huge. Now, Mr. Falcone is obviously listed on the Forbes list with a net worth of about $1.2 billion. Now, this whole thing, you know, centers around him not wanting to, you know, have his personal stuff appraised. He wanted to do something, didn't want to use his art or his apartments or any of his assets as collateral. He just borrowed the money from other people's funds. That's all. It was only a short-term thing, right? Wrong. Do you think he's going to go to jail? Let me just ask that. Do you think Mr. Billionaire is going to go to jail? What I love about this is that he's agreed. They've agreed to this. And it's always been my kind of funny moment where, you know, this woman who look, she was wrong. She took $15,000. Which is probably half of what she made working for the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. Wrong. Look, I'm with you. She's going to do jail time. She's going to spend a year or two of her life locked up or in jail, or she's going to do some really strenuous probation with people intruding on her life. Our billionaire friend ain't going to happen. You want to talk about whatever happened to that woman with the scales with the blindfold over her head? What happened to that? It's nonsensical. So I see this next story. Liechtenstein. The Bank of Liechtenstein. Evidently, they've entered into a non-prosecution agreement. They agreed that they're going to pay $23.8 million to settle a criminal tax case. Nobody going to jail there either. And what I found interesting, and the reason I brought it up, is the bank was represented by a law firm in New York, the Bank of Liechtenstein. Evidently, what turns out, and you got to wonder, the bank pled guilty. Evidently, they were kind of hiding money of U.S. taxpayers in their bank and didn't disclose this. And neither did the people. So the bank is going to have to forfeit the $16 million, and they're going to have to pay in excess of $7 million in restitution to the IRS, which good for the IRS. They're finally doing something. But I find it interesting that Liechtenstein, anybody going to jail from Liechtenstein? No. You know who goes to jail? The little person. And I'm not defending her. I'm not defending and saying what she did was right. But I'm saying that in the underneath that veil of blindness of justice, do you think it works out? I mean, you look at these billionaire hedge fund managers. You look at the people who brought our economy to its knees. Have they been held accountable? The answer is No, man. And what they've done a great job of is taking the money that they stole from us, from our pension funds, and the money that we gave them. Oh, please don't crash our economy any further. Please don't. They've taken that money and they've used it against us in the messaging campaigns to tell us, oh, it's not us. Not us. It's not us, the white collar criminal thieves on Wall Street. No, it's those teachers. It's those pensions. It's them. Over there. Look. Oh, quick. Over there. I mean, doesn't it kind of make you think that, you know, we're being sold a pile of steaming you-know-what? At some point, don't we then go, wait a second. All of the malarkey, all of the horse pucky that they keep feeding us is wrong. I got to be honest with you. I look at the mainstream media and I read a lot of these reports that come out of these big newspapers and the conglomerate news media, and I don't believe a word of it. You know, I've been looking, you know, what I like to do is I like to find a story and then I like to Google it, because I like Google. I got to be honest. I like the fact that I can look at, you know, 15 different versions of the same story, and then I realize they're all the same story. Because there's very little independent thought going on. It's all being coordinated from it's the tinfoil coming out. No, it's not. The reality is what it is. We're being fed the news, the information. We're being fed the message that the very well-to-do in this country want in order to control what goes on. So that nobody thinks twice about sending a woman who stole $15,000 from the state to jail. But nobody also questions the fact that a billionaire who stole $113 billion doesn't go to jail. Or am I just wrong? Do I miss the point? Do I not see the greater good where the billionaire, well, he's a billionaire. He's good for the economy. Yeah. All of the theft and all of the all of the shenanigans, that was good for our economy, wasn't it? Especially in 2009 as it was free-falling. Yeah, good stuff. Anyway, if you missed any part of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, Stitcher on your smartphone, email Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break, hour two. Stick around. We're right back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. About 250 people returned to Wisconsin's Capitol Rotunda Monday singing their daily noon hour protest songs as Capitol Police arrested more people.
I have the First Amendment right to be here to record this.
Stay back.
Take your hands off me. We are free still. Anything to say about the arrest?
The right of the people peaceably to assemble, to consult for the common good, and to petition their government or any department thereof shall never be abridged. This officer arresting me right now is violating the Constitution he was sworn to protect.
Out of the way, please!
Madison Police Detective Brian Austin joined the Solidarity Sing-Along on Monday. Austin protested as part of Cops for Labor during the Wisconsin uprising of 2011.
Kind of the last straw for me when I'm seeing journalists and our elected representatives and children arrested. This just has to stop. This is the United States of America. Our First Amendment rights are what make us Americans.
Active and retired firefighters in their fire hats, like Rory Board, also stood shoulder to shoulder with the Solidarity Sing-Along. Board urges more union members to join the Solidarity Sing-Along.
They ought to come up here and sing. is one thing they ought to do. Be seen and voice their opposition to this illegal shutdown on human rights, on our
constitutional rights.
First Amendment rights, freedom of speech. Does not need a permit. That's why we're here.
Ordered by Scott Walker's administration to arrest peacefully assembled singers, the cops have also arrested journalists. They shoved at least one reporter today as the reporter tried to record the arrests. Marty Beal is head of the Wisconsin Employees Union affiliated with AFSCME. He's urging unions and others to send more people to the Capitol to uphold First Amendment rights.
We've seen the crowds grow here, and the crowds need to continue to grow because, as I said in my piece, is that this is the last remnant of what Walker hasn't been able to take away from working men and women. So we need to preserve this. This is ours. This is in our house. Now's the time. Now's the time.
Two people arrested for singing continued to sing as they were led away in handcuffs for singing protest songs in Wisconsin's Capitol Rotunda. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Yes, take the money and run. In fact, salary of almost $69,000 has been doled out to Anna Pugh. You may know her as the head of the Kitchen Table Patriots. One of those T-Twit groups. She ran around the state for a while saying, Obama's a Marxist. He was born in Kenya. She defended a Nazi memorabilia dealer. You think, okay, you got a kook running around screaming stuff. Our governor, who, according to Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, is the worst governor in America. They claim that he has turned Pennsylvania's state government into a favor mill of campaign supporters. Well, in line with that theory, he named the Tea Party twit Anna Pugh as the legislative liaison for the Department of Revenue. Like I said yesterday, it's like putting a guy in charge of brain surgery who doesn't believe in the brain. Sad stuff. Anyway, here to talk about what's going on in the state of Pennsylvania with our roads and our bridges as our governor is attempting to make Pennsylvania the Texas of the Northeast. And as I said yesterday, the story, Texas is converting 80 miles of its paved road into gravel because, no money. Maybe there's something going on. Maybe there's a thought here, which I've asked Abe Amaros, Pennsylvania Legislative Director for LIUNA, to come talk to us. Abe, what do you think? Turn our roads into gravel. 81, just make it a gravel road.
That's a terrible idea, Rick. And this is just another example of not putting the right amount of resources into fixing our infrastructure. And it's just going to keep crumbling, to the point where it's got to be gravel. And it's absolutely reprehensible.
So, then we don't have to do anything and it'll just become gravel on its own? Is that what you're saying?
That's unbelievable. The way we're headed right now, Rick, that's probably what might happen unless action is taken. And the legislature is going to come back on September the 23rd, and their first order of business has to be infrastructure, has to be transportation funding, or else we're going to be headed in that direction, which is absolutely inexcusable. And the other folks who should be clamoring about this should be the Chamber of Commerce. They represent all these businesses. They represent firms that have to move their products and their goods. Why aren't they squawking just as loud as everybody else? Understand it.
I said yesterday that our governor had said at one point that he wants to make Pennsylvania the Texas of the Northeast. And I looked at, the report put out by the under the infrastructure report card by the American Civil Engineers Group. Rates, different states' roads and bridges and their infrastructure pretty much giving the country a poor grade. But they pointed out that 38% of Texas's roads are either in poor condition or mediocre condition. And I'm going, what's Pennsylvania? So I looked at Pennsylvania's. 57% of Pennsylvania's roads are in either poor condition or mediocre condition.
That's right, and that rate is absolutely unacceptable, completely unacceptable. And this is nothing new, Rick. This should have been addressed from day one of since the time he got elected, but he hasn't done it. All he's done is paid lip service. We're going to be approaching the one-year anniversary of his plan to actually do something. And nothing has been done so far. And that commission report sits there gathering dust while legislators cannot come to any kind of an agreement on what needs to be done, where the money is going to be spent, how it's going to be spent. And, you know, you got five different caucuses within the Republican ranks. They don't talk to each other. They don't like each other. And it doesn't look like anything's going to happen so far. And it's, again, it's absolutely reprehensible. And when you have an inept governor at the top of the ladder who's doing absolutely nothing to further the debate and policy and is stepping all over himself, because I got to tell you, I was on a show with Anna Puig, and she was awful, brother, let me tell you. We were talking about the prevailing wage. And she just hated workers to the nth degree by claiming that these projects cost too much because of labor. So she doesn't want to have skilled labor out there either working on these roads and bridges and highways that need all this kind of attention. So, you know, he's just tripping all over himself. He doesn't know what to do, and his polling numbers continue to dwindle. And, you know, Rick, I think that, you know, he's just throwing up his hands and doing whatever he feels is necessary, or I don't know, maybe he wants to reward all these people that helped him out during the campaign, but he's going about things the wrong way, and that's not how a governor should act or lead in Pennsylvania.
No, I'm with you. But, you know, here's the thing. As put out by CREW, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, as they said, look, I mean, he has turned our state into our state government into a favor mill. You know, and this, her appointment to me signals that this is a desperate attempt of a campaign, to try and salvage some favor with the moneyed interest.
That's right. That's exactly right, Reagan. You know what else he's trying to do in a very cynical way? He got pinched several months ago for not being able to name one Latino in his government. And maybe this is just another cynical attempt to kill two birds with one stone. Why don't we appease some of these whack job groups out there, and at the same time, we'll appoint this Latina to the post as well. Well, let me tell you, this lady doesn't speak my language, brother. I'll tell you that right now. I think that that was a horrific move, a boneheaded move, a short-sighted move, and he deserves all the criticism he gets for putting somebody in a responsible position like that.
But, you know, the other part of this is not just as crazy as her group is and some of the really far out bizarre things she said. It's putting someone who doesn't believe in taxes, in a position in the Department of Revenue that we need to bring revenue in so that we can fix roads and bridges. It seems to me that we've now put somebody in that position who doesn't believe in it. So what signal does that send to big corporations? Does it send the signal that, hey, you know, nobody's going to enforce this. Nobody's going to come after us. We're just not going to pay.
That's exactly the signal that it sends, Rick. You nailed it. That's exactly what the signal is out there. Nobody seems to care. They don't care about the core functions of government. All these guys want to do is starve it to death, make people hate it, make people more cynical about it, and maybe there'll be no bad attention coming in Corbett's way because people are going to be so, I don't know, just so demoralized in looking at it. But, you know, it's backfiring, and I'm glad that the heat is still on him. I mean, he's made all kinds of boneheaded moves. You saw what he did last week, Rick, by not reporting a $264,000 vacation home on his statement, his financial statements.
But how, the form was confusing.
Yeah, the form was confusing. He was only the top lawyer in Pennsylvania, and yet the forms were confusing. And of course, he doesn't have anybody to help him out with these things either. He does this all by himself at a kitchen table at midnight. You know?
Yeah, well, he stays up at night. You know, he's up nights worrying about the budget, as he said a number of times. And, you know, he didn't want to, you know, it's like the dumb kid in class who doesn't want to raise his hand and ask a question.
Right.
He didn't want anyone to know that he didn't know, so he just kind of winged it. Maybe.
Not only did he wing it, but then he tried to walk it back because I loved his excuse that, well, geez, you know, we hadn't settled on the house yet when we filled out the form. I mean, come on. Anybody could tell you that you have to be extraordinarily careful and conservative when it comes to these matters. I mean, he tried to hoodwink the people of Pennsylvania once again. It backfired miserably. This is just another series of missteps that the guy's taken. And you know what? I mean, I don't feel sorry for him. I feel badly for him, but I don't feel sorry for him because he knows better. And, you know, I feel badly for him because he's a human being. But at the same time, he deserves exactly what he gets, because this administration has been riddled with just absolutely horrible legislation, no ideas whatsoever, and an inability to get along with members of your own party who are in the majority to get anything accomplished, such as infrastructure and transportation funding. It is absolutely amazing. And that is exactly why Pennsylvania remains at the top of the list of states that are looking to change governors in 2014. And I'm sure that that's going to continue, because as long as he keeps tripping over himself and making these bad decisions, bad moves, and not pushing forth sound policy that works for the benefit of taxpayers and the people of Pennsylvania, he's just going to continue on this downward spiral.
Now, I got to be honest with you. You know, I look at the purchase of the house in South Carolina, and you can call it a vacation home if you want. I think that's his retirement home in 2015.
Well, I would hope so, Rick. And you know what? Good riddance. Go down to South Carolina, because those folks are just as nutty as he is.
You know, because I look at this, and you know, and while we can make light of how inept they've been, the sad reality is the policies that they're pushing are worse than they are inept.
That's exactly right. That's right. You know, there's a saying that you can be arrogant and you can be either arrogant or dumb. You can't be both. And this administration, unfortunately, has demonstrated both capacities, which is not a good thing. It doesn't speak well for leadership, and it doesn't really speak well for the people of Pennsylvania, who deserve a heck of a lot better than what they're getting right now.
But I'm told he's a very good kayaker.
Well, I don't know if he's going to take that kayak with him to South Carolina, but maybe he should. Maybe he should just strap that on top of his truck as he leaves Harrisburg.
Yeah, and I'm told that he flies well in a helicopter. I wish I could get a helicopter ride to the races as well.
That's exactly right. Well, the man does have hobbies, doesn't he, Rick?
Well, good, you know, hey, funding education, not one of them.
No.
Getting health care to the people who need it, another one, not one of them.
That's right.
There are so many things that could be done that, you know, and while we're making fun of the guy, the sad reality is there are people in our state, in our Commonwealth, who are suffering because of the things that he's done. And I look at the Philadelphia school district that's struggling because of his bad budgets, his horrible, deplorable budgets.
That's exactly right, Reagan. You know what? There is a kernel of truth in that statement, that he wants to make Pennsylvania similar to Texas, because Texas has its problems with childhood poverty, with public education. And like you mentioned earlier, 39% of its roads are considered to be structurally deficient. The bridges and the roads are just in terrible condition, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers. So, you know, maybe there is a kernel of truth to that statement that he made. And, you know, we make fun of it, like you said, but it is a sad reality. And it's just a tragic thing, because he had so many things lined up with majorities in both chambers, but an inability to communicate effectively with them and to push forward some good policy. I mean, common sense stuff. You can't get more common sense than putting roads and bridges on the agenda. It doesn't get any more common sense than creating tens of thousands of jobs in fixing our infrastructure and putting people back to work. It just doesn't get any better. He had it on a silver platter and he dropped it.
You know, the thing is you know, and you can make fun of the governor, but at the end of the day, he's still responsible for the fact that a quarter of our bridges are structurally deficient, and he's done nothing about it. That almost 20% of our bridges are functionally obsolete, and he hasn't done anything to fix that.
That's right, Rick. And I'm so glad that we have not had a tragedy. That every week when we talk about this on your program, we're not talking about someone losing his or her life, or heaven forbid, the life of a child, because of our inaction in Pennsylvania to fix our roads and bridges.
But we're going to keep on this until this transportation bill gets funded. My fear is by the time it gets funded, we'll have completely lost another season. And look, construction season's almost over now.
You're right, Rick. Yeah, I think we blew it for this year. There's no question about it. The only thing that we can hope for is a comprehensive transportation bill that they can agree upon, early on in the session so they could put people back to work and put some money on the streets and highways and then bridges for the construction season in 2014. That's the best we can hope for now. I'm hearing that there is going to be some sort of compromise, but it may be at the expense of the tax itself, the uncapping of the oil and franchise tax, because the right wing is squawking about it. So we'll see. I mean, it's still on the table, but honestly, brother, I mean, you and I have talked about this before. I'm just not as hopeful as I used to be when it comes to this, but the pressure has to remain. And people really need to be held accountable for inaction.
Yeah. Will it come at the expense of public transportation, of transit? Because, you know, the American Society of Civil Engineers, they rated our transit systems D-.
Look at that. Again, horrible. This is an essential core function of government. I mean, moving people back and forth to work, to meet with their families, to go to the doctor, to go to the supermarket. It's a core essential function of government, and yet they just don't have the courage to put money into something that needs more investments in. I mean, it's unbelievable. They lack political and moral courage.
No, it's sad stuff. But we've got to be pushing them. We've got to be calling them early. That's calling right. them often, pushing yes, them in sure. the right direction. Abe, it's great talking
Absolutely.
With you. I
Likewise.
Appreciate the time, man.
You got it. Thank you.
Our good friend Abe Amoros, Pennsylvania Legislative Director for the Laborers International Union. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU, financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Suppose we were about to vote in an election that could drastically change American government from a democratic republic to a privately owned entity run by billionaires. Actually, such a plutocratic concept is not as far-fetched today as it would have sounded 25 years ago, but still, if it was put to a vote, the American people would soundly reject it. But now, let's suppose that the plutocrats, realizing that their privatization scheme was going to lose, suddenly and arbitrarily postponed Election Day so they could have more time to run deceitful campaign ads and woo special voting blocks with promises of money. And suppose they postponed the vote 2 more times, while also rigging the election rules to jack up their vote count. One more thing. Suppose they install their own judges to rule that all this manipulation is permissible. Preposterous, you say? Can't happen in America. Well, it's happening right now. Not in a political election, but in an ongoing vote involving corporate governance. And it demonstrates the utter contempt that moneyed elites have for any rules, even their own, that get in their way of maintaining control. The chief autocrat in this real-life melodrama is Michael Dell, the multi-billionaire founder of the now-foundering Dell Computer Corporation. He recently got his hand-picked board of directors to let him and a few other financial elites turn the publicly traded giant into their private entity. In essence, they intended to seize Dell Inc. from its owners, i.e. shareholders, by using a razzle-dazzle line of hokum to cover up the fact that they were buying them out on the cheap, and even using the shareholders' own money to engineer the plutocratic coup. This is Jim Hightower saying, however, there's one group the Dell gang had not planned for, angry shareholders. From a billionaire owner to just plain folks who are getting ripped off, a rebellion has erupted. I'll tell you more about the stacking of this corporate election in our next broadcast.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common?
They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
The walls come crumbling down. The walls come crumbling, crumbling. The walls come crumbling, crumbling down.
1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So the report card from the American Society of Civil Engineers gives the state of Pennsylvania a C-minus overall. Bridges C, dam C-minus, drinking water a D-plus. I don't know if you've been hearing the commercials from American Water, Pennsylvania's American Water, telling us how much work they're doing, a D-plus. Education, a B-minus. Inland waterways, D-plus. Parks, B-minus. Rail, B-minus. Roads, D-minus. Solid waste, B-minus. Transit, D-minus. And urban runoff, D-minus, wastewater, D-plus. A lot to deal with. A lot of opportunity, though, to be honest. A lot of opportunity to put people back to work rebuilding this stuff. And if you want to bring business to Pennsylvania, jack that up to that report card up to a B grade, and you'll see people coming here. Get better roads and bridges, better drinking water, better all of these things. Better public transportation. Now understand, the transportation bill, the last session went down really for one reason. Republicans demanded to have the public transportation money stripped out of it. That was it. We're gonna make public transit worse. And what's interesting, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers, that from 2007 forward, we've seen an increase in people using public transportation. In fact, they say that it's been rising about 4% from 11 million trips or 4 million trips in 2007 to 428 million trips in 2008. In fact, the 4% increase, they claim, saved about 186 million gallons of gas. And let's not forget about the congestion and the air pollution. What they write about it, though, is they say the transit system users throughout the state will face significant service reductions. If we can't figure out a way to fund it, they're going to face significant service reductions, fare increases, and reduced mobility, especially senior citizens and persons with disabilities. They say overall, congestion will increase, air quality will suffer, and the condition and performance of our highway and bridge network will deteriorate. I don't know how much plainer that can be. Congestion is going to increase. Air quality is going to suffer. The condition and performance of our road and bridge network going to deteriorate. And yet here we are, 2 years now, going on three. We've done nothing. We've done nothing. We've attempted to stay at just mediocre. We're not upgrading. We're not repairing. We're just emergency repairs we'll fix. We've got to find money for that. When a bridge, when the bridge over here off, was it 322? When the gasoline truck flipped over and burnt the bridge up, you got a couple expansions missing. We've got to find money for that. But maintenance, but upgrading. You know, I drove through the Lehigh Valley recently, and the traffic there is unbelievable. You know, I remember when I moved to Pennsylvania back in 1993. And, you know, I moved to the Lehigh Valley. We lived in Allentown. And I remember that, you know, 22 going through Allentown was just atrocious, especially during rush hour. I mean, it could take you an hour to get past MacArthur Road or Airport Road. Everything was just crammed in there. And what have they done to alleviate that? Well, not a lot. I mean, they built 78, but 78 is too far south to actually have anything to do. When I first moved there, they were actually talking about putting a whole nother two-lane road in each direction above the one that's already there to have an express to get through the area. Because if you're not getting off at the, you know, in town, the express to blow right through. well, it's too expensive. We don't have the money to invest. So here we are, you know, 20 years later, nothing. You know, I go back to what the judge mentioned to me when I was walking with him on the anti-violence walk. And he said, you know, back in the 70s, the Harrisburg School Board was saying, hey, you know, because he was on the school board saying, hey, we want to fix the sewers because they're collapsing. And nothing got done. And you know what? From the 1970s till now, nothing's gotten done. And like our governor said, well, it didn't happen overnight. Not going to fix it overnight. In fact, we're just not going to fix it because the next guy will take care of it. And it's this kind of failed vision, this kind of carpe diem, live for today, I don't care about the future mentality that the GOME has brought us, that's harming us. Because you know what? Tomorrow is going to come. And the day after is going to be here. It's just what's going to be under our feet. What investments are going to be in place? You know, I like the congressman yesterday I talked about who was going, well, the founding fathers would be rolling over their graves if they knew Obama wanted to put high-speed internet everywhere. They wanted broadband access everywhere. They'd be rolling in their graves. Would they? I tend to think that those were guys who were forward-looking visionaries who said, you know what? They wrote a document that could change. As times change, the document could change to meet the needs of that time. Pretty forward-looking, one would have to think, don't you? And I think they'd be spinning in their graves looking at what this governor has done, which is nothing. The idea you're going to go buy a house in South Carolina? Really? While you're governor of Pennsylvania? Really? You're going to name a Tea Party ideologue to a pretty important position at the Department of Revenue? Really? Are you kidding me? I hope people are taking note of all this stuff. I hope when you open the newspaper or you see the news, you go, really? What exactly is this guy doing? Especially when you look at what he's done to education, what he's done to healthcare, and then what he's not done. To me, it's unconscionable. It is absolutely unconscionable that this guy hasn't taken the Medicaid expansion money. And, you know, for Dave Reed, the chairman of the Republican Policy Committee, to be going around the Commonwealth saying, I care about poverty, and not promoting Medicaid expansion, really shows me that it's all a sham. I'm not really interested in poverty at all. Interested in his bona fides with the billionaires. Something not right in Denmark. But I'm telling you, you know, if we don't do something about our infrastructure now, it's only going to cost us more. And the governor's own report laid that out. I mean, you know, he commissioned a report, a study right when he came into office. They handed it to him. I think it was like 72 pages. I sat down, I read through it. A lot of it I agreed with. Some of it not so thrilled about. But the one thing I absolutely agreed with on, if you don't do it today, it's going to cost us more tomorrow. And the longer we wait, the longer we stall and delay, and the more gridlock and the more obstruction, the worse our roads and bridges are going to get, with the worse our infrastructure is going to get, and the more it's going to cost. Basic, simple, common sense that any rational, thoughtful thinking person already knows. But I guess rational, thoughtful, and thinking, definitely not things I would put with the Corbett administration and today's Republican Party. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
easy for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. About 250 people returned to Wisconsin's Capitol Rotunda Monday singing their daily noon hour protest songs as Capitol Police arrested more people.
I have the First Amendment right to be here to report this.
Stay back.
Take your hands off me. We are free still. Anything to say about the arrest?
The right of the people peaceably to assemble, to consult for the common good, and to petition their government or any department thereof shall never be abridged. This officer arresting me right now is violating the Constitution he was sworn to protect.
Out of the way, please!
Madison Police Detective Brian Austin joined the Solidarity Sing-Along on Monday. Austin protested as part of Cops for Labor during the Wisconsin uprising of 2011.
Kind of the last straw for me when I am seeing journalists and our elected representatives and children arrested. This just has to stop. This is the United States of America. Our First Amendment rights are what make us Americans.
Active and retired firefighters in their fire hats, like Rory Board, also stood shoulder to shoulder with the Solidarity Sing-Along. Board urges more union members to join the Solidarity Sing-Along.
They ought to come up here and sing. Is one thing they ought to do. Be seen and voice their opposition to this illegal shutdown on human rights, on our Constitution. First Amendment rights, the freedom of speech, does not need a permit. That's why we're here.
Ordered by Scott Walker's administration to arrest peacefully assembled singers, the cops have also arrested journalists. They shoved at least one reporter today as the reporter tried to record the arrests. Marty Beal is head of the Wisconsin State Employees Union, affiliated with AFSCME. He's urging unions and others to send more people to the Capitol to uphold First Amendment rights.
We've seen the crowds grow here, and the crowds need to continue to grow because, as I said in my piece, is that this is the last remnant of what Walker hasn't been able to take away from working men and women. So we need to preserve this. This is ours. This is in our house. Now's the time. Now's the time.
Two people arrested for singing continued to sing as they were led away in handcuffs for singing protest songs in Wisconsin's Capitol Rotunda. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So in Texas, a lot of craziness going on in Texas. There's a pastor running around with an AR-15, a Bushmaster AR-15 rifle strapped to his back. He's going in and out of the Walmarts and the Starbucks because, you know, he's mad. He's angry. Can't carry my pistol, so I can carry my AR-15 in public. And one of the things I was thinking about today, you know, if I'm walking down the street and I see a guy holding an AR-15, my first thought is, who's he going to shoot? So with Texas being a stand your ground state, do I have the right to shoot him? Because, you know, he was holding a gun. I was fearful. I wanted to stand my ground. That's how the law is read. I got to get some clarification on this. Also on the AR-15 front, a father and son were killed after the AR-15 went off in the room, struck something, lit a fire, and their arsenal blew up and killed the both of them. And I know it's not the gun. It's the people. Guns don't kill people. People do. And this just blows my mind, like in Oklahoma, a couple of teenagers thought, hey, it'd be a good idea to just go kill somebody. So driving around, shot this Australian baseball player in the back and left him on the ground to die. I know, it's not the gun, right? Just like the four-year-old who fatally shot himself in the head in Michigan because the gun was, I know, it's not the gun. It's not. And my question is, and look, we can go on all day with example after example. My question is, shouldn't we have some rational laws that say we should have people who are semi-responsible, just and maybe a background check to make sure that they're stable? Because I'm just curious how a 16-year-old got a gun to go shoot this Australian kid in the back. Just my thought. I understand tomorrow there's going to be a gun violence prevention event here in Harrisburg over at the Capitol Rotunda. It's kind of like back when I was a kid, the Hands Across America. OFA is doing an event, which is why I have asked Greg Myers. He's organizing for Action. He's the state lead person for their gun violence prevention program. Greg, thanks for taking time for us.
Hello, Rick. Thank you very much for having me on the air. And yes, you are correct. We are addressing the expanded background checks issue tomorrow, not only in Harrisburg, but also in 14 other communities across the state of Pennsylvania. So we have called this event Hands Across Pennsylvania. You will have volunteers out at the same time tomorrow at noon. Yes, in Harrisburg, we'll be in the Capitol Rotunda, and we will be speaking out in support of background checks on the common sense gun violence prevention reforms, but not only in Harrisburg, but also in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and State College and Lock Haven and Scranton and Allentown and in Springfield, Delaware County, and in Chester County and in Bucks County over in Langhorne at Congressman Mike Fitzpatrick's office. We will be standing up for background checks and standing with the majority of Pennsylvanians who have already let it be known that we want these expanded background checks. Just if I can just take a moment to review here, you know, it was in April that the Senate voted down the Toomey Manchin compromise amendment for background checks. And that legislation is still sort of sitting on the back burner in the Senate. But also over in the House, we have the equivalent bill, the Thompson-King bill, H.R. 1565, which we will be supporting tomorrow. They would also expand background checks, but the House has been resistant to acting on that legislation. You know, when I think about this, when I think about the reluctance of our elected officials in Washington to bring this legislation to the forefront and to act on it, I start to think in terms of, you know, courage and bravery. And, you know, I'm thinking about all these gun violence incidents that we've become aware of and the gun violence that's happening in our country. And in so many situations and on so many of those occasions, we've observed, for example, you know, in the Gabby Giffords incident out in Tucson, you know, there was a man who came up behind the gunman and pulled the clip, or okay, maybe I should say magazine. I'm not going to quibble over the nomenclature here, right. But whether it was a clip or a magazine, That's right. That's right. He took the ammunition away. And in Newtown, the school administrators who put themselves in between the bullets and the children to buy time there. Not only that, but let's just think about every day in all of our cities across America, the bravery of the school children. You know, tomorrow is the first day of school in Harrisburg, but all across our country, school children just walking to school and back every day are showing bravery that, well, you and I never had to muster up that kind of bravery when we were kids. The most telling example of that, I believe, is in several years ago. You may remember the nickel mines incident over in Lancaster County, when a madman with a gun came into an Amish school.
Yes, I do.
Sent all the boys out, kept the girls inside, and was preparing to just gun down these girls one by one. And the first little girl stepped forward. There were two girls that were sisters. I believe one was 11 and one was 9. And the first girl, the 11-year-old, stepped forward, and she could see that this man was torn, was mentally anguished, and to buy time, she said to him, "Kill me first. Kill me first." 11-year-old girl stepping up to certain death and saying, "Kill me first." And then her sister did the same thing, you know, all in an effort to buy time. I, as a tale of of bravery and courage, I don't think there's anything greater than that. And now I think about our legislators in Washington and how if they could just summon up one millionth of that courage to stand up to the special interest on the other side of this issue, we would have this legislation passed. And I don't want to take this opportunity. I want to thank Representative Fitzpatrick, Mike Fitzpatrick over in Bucks County, and I want to thank Representative Patrick Meehan in Delaware County and serving several other counties. But also I need to thank Charlie Dent up in the Lehigh Valley area, not to mention our senators, Senator Casey and Senator Toomey. You know, they've all decided on this issue. They will stand up to their special interests. And so what we will be doing tomorrow is calling upon our other members of Congress to do the same, to join with, I mean, not only is Mike Fitzpatrick and Patrick Meehan, not only are they supporting the legislation, they're co-sponsors. And if we could just get them to get our other elected officials, specifically, you know, we're looking to representatives like Jim Gerlach in the 6th Congressional District and Tom Marino up in the Northeast Pennsylvania, up in CD10, and also Tim Murphy over in Southwestern Pennsylvania. We're looking to them specifically to step up, join with their colleagues, and support this background check legislation.
What about my Congressman Lou Barletta? Where's Lou on this issue?
Well, Lou has not yet stepped up to support the issue, and certainly we will be making ourselves known to Mr. Lou Barletta. We have an event in Scranton.
Good.
He'll see us on the news. He'll know we're busy. We're actively asking him and all of our legislators to support the background.
Because here's the thing, Greg. Here's the thing. Most of the NRA members that I know, they're sane and they're rational. The national NRA, they've kind of gone off the deep end here. Most people, I think, agree that there should be a measure of background checks. We want to make sure that we keep guns out of the hands of criminals while making sure that we're not infringing on the rights of law-abiding gun owners to own their guns and all of that. What are we specifically asking for? Are we looking at taking away the gun show loophole? Are we looking at closing some of the avenues that people are getting guns going around the system? What exactly is it that we want people to know tomorrow, and so that they can ask for and say this is what we have to have? What are we looking at?
Well, good question. And I will get into some of the specifics of that. Now, I have to say I'm not a policy expert. I'm not a legislative expert. But some of the specifics of the House Bill 1565 is also known as the King-Thompson Bill. It would require background checks for all gun sales in commercial settings, including at gun shows, on the Internet, and in classified ads. And it would also improve the existing background check system and streamline the gun laws.
What do you say to the argument then that you're really doing is keeping guns out of the hands of law-abiding citizens? The criminals, they'll find a way, Greg, because criminals know how to get guns.
Well, criminal background checks would be required. So there is a point there, but if we follow that philosophy in all of our lawmaking, I don't think we'd have any laws. You know, if we said, well, we have all of these safeguards in our legal system and we do so much to prevent people from robbing banks, but banks still get robbed. So let's just get rid of all of the legislation that makes it illegal to rob banks. I don't think so.
Well, the bank robbery now that's going on, it's going on by the bank presidents and the CEOs and Wall Street. Not so much the Bonnie and Clydes anymore. But that's an argument for a whole nother day. I want to focus on this. Tomorrow at noon, over at the Capitol Rotunda, you're going to have this event. What are you expecting to come out of this? How many people are you expecting?
Well, You know, I do want to point out that so many statewide events are held in Harrisburg where people from all over the state are asked to come to that Capitol Rotunda, and that is not what we're doing, because we are, you know, embracing this theme of Hands Across Pennsylvania, and we are having these events in 14 other towns and cities across our state. So this will be, by those standards, I guess it would be a rather modest event, but the folks coming out for this, you know, I'm expecting, not more than 40 people. The folks coming out for this event in Harrisburg inside the Rotunda tomorrow will be standing, you know, hey, do you remember a couple of years ago there were some cellular phone ads on television where there would be a close-up of the cell phone technicians? And then as the advertisement went on, the camera would zoom out and you would see this entire force of their company standing
yep.
there behind them.
Yes.
Well, that's what we'll be doing. We'll have a really good, passionate group of people. And we know that behind them, the vast majority of Pennsylvanians, I believe it's 88% of all Pennsylvanians, support background checks, expanding background checks on gun sales. And that's who will be behind us, and that's who we're representing across the street, is those folks. Literally, we will be doing the Hands Across Pennsylvania thing, because at a precise point in time, all across the state, at these events, we will be lining up and holding hands as a solid gesture of solidarity and unity on this issue, because we want it to be known that we are not backing down. And we ask the question, what will it take? What will it take to get this legislation passed? And we will continue to ask that question, and we will continue to pursue this issue. So as folks leave this event, you know, we'll have a renewed sense of urgency around this issue, and we'll be asking folks to call their congressman to demand that they not only support but co-sponsor this legislation and make it happen. Let's implement some common sense expanded background checks in Washington.
I'm right there with you, Greg. It was great talking with you. I appreciate it. I look forward to seeing you tomorrow at the Capitol Rotunda, noon here in Harrisburg, if you want to come out and join Greg and the others from Organizing for Action. I appreciate the time, Greg. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
All righty, Greg Myers. He is the gun violence prevention volunteer with Organizing for Action, Pennsylvania. Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk.
One of these days we want to wake up.
Show, changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
On July 5th, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry." industry. Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The man who sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. Your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. On Monday, there was an Air Force B-1 bomber that crashed in southeastern Montana. It was on a routine training mission, according to a number of news outlets, when it crashed. The interesting thing that caught my attention is that the two pilots, they ejected, and, you know, they made it to safety, a couple of minor injuries. But the two weapon systems, they ejected as well, along with the weapon systems officers ejected. The thing that I found interesting is the B-1 was put into work back in 1985. So you're talking about a plane that's fairly old. It was developed by Boeing. The Air Force has about 60 of these B-1s in its arsenal. And according to the Air Force, cost about $283 million to replace. So I was thinking, you know, hey, the crash, kind of a stimulus, right? Because we're going to need a new one now. Maybe as part of, you know, 1985, you know, the bombers, you know, we could probably use some new ones, right? What interested me, though, is they showed pictures of what was left, and there's nothing left. Nothing, just charred black ground. And, you know, as I was looking at the pictures, I'm going, well, where's the fuselage? Where are the wings? Where's everything at? Did they get there quick enough to cart it all away, or is the plane like safety glass? Hits the ground and it just evaporates. Which I think would be kind of cool if it did. Interesting. Anyway, one of the questions that, you know, I've been thinking about with this gun stuff. You know, I go back to that the crazy pastor in Texas walking around in the Walmart and walking into, you know, different, you know, the local Jack in the Box and all of the places with this massive gun strapped to his back. What would you think? I mean, you know, this, you know, one of the things that I grew up in an area where you saw somebody with a gun, duck, because they're going to use it on someone. And I know this is an area where I live now. It's an area where, you know, guns are a little more cultural. You know, it's something you pass down family member to family member, and I get that. But when you see somebody walking around with what looks like an assault rifle, does your mind go to, uh-oh? Because I got to be honest, if I saw that, my mind would go, uh-oh, trouble, crazy guy with a gun, look out. Because, you know, and I guess I was talking about this with Brett, the producer here, the other day. You know, when you walk into a room and you assess, you know, in the room and the risk associated with it, because I do, and I guess, you know, as my wife said, it's probably a mechanism of where I grew up, that you didn't walk into a playground or you didn't walk into somewhere without knowing where trouble was and knowing who was behind you. And you know, she pointed out that I naturally, wherever I go to a restaurant, I always have my, I'm always in the corner. My back is never to people. And it's not something I do consciously. It's just something that is automatic. And is that a product of, you know, growing up where I did? Or I would assume, but I'm not sure. But, you know, you see somebody with a gun and immediately, you've got to be thinking, uh-oh, here's trouble. And that's what concerns me about a lot of this crazy protest stuff. Because you got these guys wrong. The guy had a loaded AR-15 walking through a Walmart. Or, you know, through any of these places. And you go, okay, well, when does his right to do that infringe upon mine? And I think back to the Starbucks story we talked about last Friday, or last Thursday, where the woman, oops, I didn't know my gun was in my purse when I threw it on the floor and it discharged and shot my friend in the leg. Oops, I'm sorry. And she wasn't charged with anything. That's the thing that blows my mind. You go, oh, it was an accident. Accident, my backside. Somebody got shot. I mean, at some point, don't we have to hold these people accountable? Look, if I run my car into something, I got to pay for it, right? I mean, I don't know. You know, I look at this and it's mind-blowing to me. But I was thinking about the Texas story and I'm going, you know, I know Texas is a stand-your-ground state. And the way those laws are written is, you know, if you're standing your ground and you fear for your life, you can use deadly force. So if I'm standing there, I see this guy coming at me with a loaded AR-15. Having heard the stories from Newtown, having heard the stories, in Aurora, and having heard, you know, all of these stories that are pervasive through our media. And look, I could come on the air every night and tick off 10 of these gun stories every single night of some dimwit dropping a gun, shooting themselves, or some kid getting a hold of a gun and shooting somebody else. There are tons of these stories out there. Our mainstream media doesn't cover them because the gun industry is very powerful. But don't we have to hold people accountable at some level? I mean, with all of this news out there, especially with these mass shootings, you know, isn't it reasonable to think that maybe the guy's up to no good and couldn't I shoot him? Any thoughts on that? I'd be interested. Got to take a quick break. Right back with hour three. Stick around. You'll listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the dog.
For the homeless, for the poor, who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the Golden Dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Ginsburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. About 250 people returned to Wisconsin's Capitol Rotunda Monday singing their daily noon hour protest songs as Capitol Police arrested more people.
I have a First Amendment right to be here to report this.
Stay back.
Take your hands off me. We are free. Still
in this country.
Anything to say about the arrest?
The right of the people peaceably to assemble, to consult for the common good, and to petition our government or any department thereof shall never be abridged. This officer arresting me right now is violating the Constitution he was sworn to protect.
Out of the way, please.
Madison Police Detective Brian Austin joined the Solidarity Sing-Along on Monday. Austin protested as part of Cops for Labor during the Wisconsin uprising of 2011.
Kind of the last straw for me when I'm seeing journalists and our elected representatives and children arrested. This just has to stop. This is the United States of America. Our First Amendment rights are what make us Americans.
Active and retired firefighters in their fire hats, like Rory Board, also stood shoulder to shoulder with the Solidarity Sing-Along. Board urges more union members to join the Solidarity Sing-Along.
They ought to come up here and sing, is one thing they ought to do. Be seen and voice their opposition to this illegal shutdown on human rights, on our Constitution. First Amendment rights, freedom of speech. It does not need a permit. That's why we're here.
Ordered by Scott Walker's administration to arrest peacefully assembled singers, the cops have also arrested journalists. They shoved at least one reporter today as the reporter tried to record the arrests. Marty Beal is head of the Wisconsin State Employees Union, affiliated with AFSCME. He's urging unions and others to send more people to the Capitol to uphold First Amendment rights.
We've seen the crowds grow here, and the crowds need to continue to grow because, as I said in my piece, is that this is the last remnant of what Walker hasn't been able to take away from working men and women. So we need to preserve this. This is ours. This is in our house. Now's the time. Now's the time.
Two people arrested for singing continued to sing as they were led away in handcuffs for singing protest songs in Wisconsin's Capitol Rotunda. You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Neither of these things absolves us from blame. So speaking for the senior management team and myself, while we can't assure you we won't make mistakes, we can assure you we're going to try not to. These were egregious mistakes. They were self-inflicted. We are accountable. And what happened violates our own standards and principles by how we want to operate the company. This is not how we want to run a business.
Well, they don't want to get caught. That's the thing. That's not how you operate. Stealing all of our money and foreclosing our homes and all that, that's perfectly getting caught. That's the problem. Anyway, welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So over the past couple of years, we've been talking to homeowners across the country who have been told, and this just blows my mind. I call, let's say I have a mortgage. I call my bank, I say, look, I'm struggling, I'm having trouble making my mortgage. Can we work something out? And the first thing they tell me is, stop making your payments. Get 3-4 months behind, and then we'll talk to you. That makes no sense to me. But I guess if you look at it from the frame that get you behind, so that we can run you through the process of foreclosure so we can steal your house, then it makes better sense. So when I see people in the streets fighting, trying to protect people's homes, I'm all in favor. And I guess on Monday, there was a march through the streets of Minneapolis, Minnesota, through Chase Bank, through City Hall, and a bunch of activities. People with big balloon banners and life-size puppets and people suspended from 20-foot tripods defending people's homes. You got to talk to somebody from that, which is why we've asked Jonathan Sabellos. He is one of the folks who his home is being foreclosed on by Chase Bank. Jonathan, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. Thank you for this time.
You know, I look at this, and congratulations on being able to hold this off. But the story that I want to get into is, how did you get into this situation?
Well, 3 years ago, actually, my father became a single father, and we were actually, you know, he got caught up in payments and was no longer able to keep up.
So you called the bank and said, hey, you know, I'm struggling. I need a little help. What'd they tell you?
Absolutely. You know, they kept asking for paperwork. We kept sending paperwork, and they lost the paperwork.
Of course
and,
they
you
did.
Know, just never got anywhere with it.
And at some point, did they tell you that things were going to be okay? It's like, because, you know, we've talked to a number of people over the years who said, look, you know, we did all that they asked us. They send us paperwork. We fill it out. We send it back. They lose it. We do it again. And we play this game back and forth. But at some point, someone
I would assume, had to say, you know, we're okay, we're moving in the right direction, we're, you know, something, right?
Well, this summer, actually, they asked for our loan modification. You know, they said, turn it in by June 20th, and we'll try to see if we can work something. You know, we did everything they told us. At the same time, they did what's called dual tracking, and they moved forward and filed for eviction.
So while they're telling you, we're going to be working with you, keep sending us money, they're filing to get you kicked out and steal your house while still taking money from you.
Well, they asked for the paperwork, and they also decide to evict us. That's what they're doing. So they say they're going to work with us, and then they go ahead and move forward with eviction.
And I understand that they sent the sheriffs out to evict you, and in pretty large numbers, if I got this right, right?
Yes, we actually had 30 sheriffs show up, and but with the community and the support, we were able to scare them away, I'm going to say.
Well, that's what I like to hear. So who are you working with? I mean, I know there are a number of groups out there. We've been talking to people from the Home Defenders League. There are a bunch of Occupy groups that are occupying people's homes. Who in your area, who are the groups that you're working with that are helping you?
We're working with Occupy Homes Minnesota. You know, it's thanks to them and the community that we're able to move forward and fight for our home.
And where are you right now? I understand July 24th is when the 30 sheriffs came out and I guess arrested two people. Where are you right now?
Yes, I'm still located in South Minneapolis. You know, I have younger siblings, so school's starting. We have a little backup plan, but that doesn't stop us from fighting, and that's not going to stop us from moving out of our home.
What's it going to mean to your family if they are able to throw you out of your home?
Well, we've been there for 13 years, so, you know, we have memories. We went to school around the neighborhood, you know, worked. It's going to be a big, you know, a sad moment, but I'm not looking at that right now. Right now what we're looking at is the home defense that we're working, the community, and moving forward and scaring Chase, letting them know that we want negotiation, we want affordable payments, and we're going to stay with their home.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense to me, Jonathan, for the bank to take your home away from you when you're willing to pay. And it seems to me that there's got to be a way, not just in your case, but in the millions of other cases across the country where the banks, the federal government, homeowners can sit down at a table and figure this out to keep people in their homes, to keep the housing market from going further down, and to keep having these vacant homes that we've seen across the country. It just seems rational for me that they'd want to keep you in your house.
Exactly. You know, I mean, dual tracking is illegal under the National Mortgage Settlement. So why can't we find a creative solution? You know, it's an easy fix. It's nothing hard, nothing more. You know, we want to stay in the home. We want to live there. We want to pay. And right now, what are they doing? They have empty homes. There's no one paying for them. And that's not what we want.
And they're a burden on the taxpayer, I mean, as well, because when you have blight and you have properties that are falling down, they've got to be taken care of. And the banks aren't doing this. I mean, we took a tour across the country back in June. And, you know, you go through places like Detroit and Cleveland and St. Louis and Kansas City where, you know, and in Nevada where you just had mass foreclosures where neighborhoods are struggling. And I mean, you go through Detroit where entire neighborhoods are abandoned. To me, that doesn't seem to be good for the community. It doesn't seem to be good for society. And I don't know that it's good for the banks either.
Exactly. Exactly.
So let me ask you this, you know, and because, you know, I know people sometimes feel helpless. You know, I know when all of this foreclosure stuff was going on at the very beginning, I felt the helpless. You know, how do we help people stay in their homes? And I got to be honest, I'm excited to see that there are more people doing what you guys are doing there in Minnesota. Explain the scene to us because, you know, I don't think a lot of us in our listening get that kind of direct action, that kind of that activity that really that kind of control that you guys are putting forth. How many people would you say came to your house and sat in?
Well, one of our events, we had almost or about 250 supporter. So that was very blessing to see and to have a community stand in front of a yard, stand together with us, but not only us, for the movement. You know, like you mentioned, it's not good what the banks are doing. I mean, not only, in my neighborhood, there's 3 empty homes as it is. You know, why one more?
Yeah, that it makes no sense to me. You know, because, and I guess it's policy that comes from above as well. I mean, you know, I personally think we need to get rid of DeMarco, you know, the guy who oversees a good bit of this policy, and put somebody in there who's going to, well, from the very beginning, I was someone who said there had to be principal reduction, there had to be refinancing, there had to be, a way to take, everybody gets a little bit of a haircut. The banks, the homeowners, everything, and we little principal reduction, reduce the rates, so that you keep this thing from going. And it's just been all of these years later, and we're still talking about this, Jonathan. That's what's frustrating to me, and I think a lot of people.
That's right.
So what can we do to help?
Well, you can contact your local union. I know my father, SEIU, healthcare supports us. And, there's Occupy Homes, there's getting involved, you know, finding out more information.
And telling your story. Look, I give you all the credit in the world, Jonathan, because it's got to be difficult to be going through this for anybody, even with the support that you've gotten. I know a lot of people that, you know, your pride and all of that comes into it to come out and tell you the story that you're struggling. I give you credit for it, because the more that we can get people to say, hey, look, you know, this is what's happening to me, the faster I think we can stop it.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
I appreciate the time, Jonathan Sabellos. I look at this, and, you know, as we've been talking about for some time, you know, this whole foreclosure thing to me on so many levels could have been averted from the very beginning had we just done what I thought we should have done from the very beginning, which was just to do what we did in the past. And I go back to the FDR years, where the Home Ownership Loan Corporation, where they said, you know what, we're going to buy up those mortgages. We're going to lower it. We're going to have a low rate. It's going to be for 30 years. We're going to take on that. We're going to make sure that we stop the free fall. And there were some who thought that that's what was going to happen. Problem is, we've been sold this bunch of bull, that private is better. It's much better to have a private for-profit corporation do this. Let the banks do it. So we had the banks do the modification, which they severely effed up. And part of me goes, it wasn't that they screwed it up. It's that they did it on purpose. They knew exactly what they were doing to maximize their money. And all you people, be damned. I'm telling you, from the very beginning, I think this was another heist. And the very people who were supposed to be helping us to make sure that communities were stabilized, because at the end of the day, whether you were involved in it or not, you were involved in it. Whether you think it was part of you, you were involved in it. When homes in your neighborhood go up under foreclosure, when homes in your neighborhood are being foreclosed upon, it's hurting you. And I guess that's where we've kind of forgotten that community thing. We've kind of forgotten it's been so long we've been sold this mentality that we're all cowboys, when the reality is truthfully, we're astronauts. We're all dependent on each other. Hooray for me only works so far. Look what it got us in 2008. And look what it's still getting us, because we're allowing these bankers to get even larger. Let's take a quick break. I'd be interested in your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Suppose we were about to vote in an election that could drastically change American government from a democratic republic to a privately owned entity run by billionaires. Actually, such a plutocratic concept is not as far-fetched today as it would have sounded 25 years ago, but still, if it was put to a vote, the American people would soundly reject it. But now, let's suppose that the plutocrats, realizing that their privatization scheme was going to lose, suddenly and arbitrarily postponed Election Day so they could have more time to run deceitful campaign ads and woo special voting blocks with promises of money. And suppose they postponed the vote two more times, while also rigging the election rules to jack up their vote count. One more thing. Suppose they install their own judges to rule that all this manipulation is permissible. Preposterous, you say? Can't happen in America. Well, it's happening right now. Not in a political election, but in an ongoing vote involving corporate governance. And it demonstrates the utter contempt that moneyed elites have for any rules, even their own, that get in their way of maintaining control. The chief autocrat in this real-life melodrama is Michael Dell, the multi-billionaire founder of the now-foundering Dell Computer Corporation. He recently got his hand-picked board of directors to let him and a few other financial elites turn the publicly traded giant into their private entity. In essence, they intended to seize Dell Inc. from its owners, i.e. shareholders, by using a razzle-dazzle line of hokum to cover up the fact that they were buying them out on the cheap, and even using the shareholders' own money to engineer the plutocratic coup. This is Jim Hightower saying, however, there's one group the Dell gang had not planned for, angry shareholders. From a billionaire owner to just plain folks who are getting ripped off, a rebellion has erupted. I'll tell you more about the stacking of this corporate election in our next broadcast.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
John, there's a real difference between venture capitalism and vulture capitalism. The fact of the matter is that he's going to have to face up to this at some time or another.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
You know, I go back to this whole foreclosure thing, and I didn't want to really go off too much on this, but it's one of those things that we've been trained for the last 40 years, last 50 years, to believe that government's bad, private, for-profit corporation, good. Because the conservative movement, the business community, used the minions of conservatism to say, oh, you know, government did all these bad things, you know, like save the economy from collapse and save Wall Street and all of that, save, you know, the entire economy here in the U.S. after the Depression. And they didn't like what Roosevelt did. They didn't like Social Security. They didn't like unemployment insurance. They didn't like workers' compensation. They didn't like, you know, they didn't like any of the minimum wage. They didn't like, you know, the right of workers to organize, heaven forbid. They didn't like any of that stuff. You know, go down the list. And they began fighting back, which is, oh, the government's bad. And they would point out individual cases, you know, oh, you know, see what they did here? Like the Spicoli character that they've dug up for food stamps. It's all part of this push to say, well, government bad, private good. And nothing more glaring to me. I got an email as we were talking about the gun issue, talking about the NRA. Over at BuzzFeed, there's a story titled, How the NRA Built a Massive Secret Database of Gun Owners. They've got a huge, you know, tens of millions of gun owners with all of their information. They've compiled all of this information without really the gun owner's consent, well, you would think. I'm upset about that. Had the government secretly compiled, you know, tens of millions of gun owners without their consent, do you think there'd be a hue and cry? No. And I guess it's because we've been trained, like Pavlovian dogs. We've been trained to say, well, you know, this is private interest. They've got all of it. No big deal. It's kind of like when I went to Disney, talking to the T-Twit who, the government's evil and bad government. But we walked through the turnstile. He had no problem putting his thumbprint on the little scanner and then answering a whole bunch of personal survey questions when he got through. Had not a problem giving all of his information to a private for-profit Disney corporation. Had no problem with that. But, you know, as I asked the guy, if on the corner of your census report, if they asked for your thumbprint, what would you say? I wouldn't do it. I go, but you just gave it to a for-profit corporation and didn't even think about it. And this has been something that's been in the works for years. And to me, a lot of this comes back to Milton Friedman and this whole Chicago economics, this whole Chicago school that, you know, markets are good, government is bad. That's it. Bottom line. The markets are always right. They will always fix what is wrong. Just leave them alone. Which is what came of all of the deregulation and all of the, you know, the lower taxes and all of the, you know, let business be. The same crap we hear today. And it has been rammed down our throats. And I'm telling you, before all of this, the economic theory was allowing corporations to get too big is both economically insane but politically insane because you've given these corporate entities so much power. The people who trained the Milton Friedmans and the Robert Borks and those folks, they understood that, you know, giving disproportionate amount of power to these huge corporations is a bad idea. Yet we here now seem to think, wow, it's a great idea. Companies getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Antitrust laws are almost non-existent. They nibble around the edges, but you're never going to see another Teddy Roosevelt. You're never going to see a guy who, and I got to be honest, at the beginning I had hoped Obama would do a little bit. Didn't happen, but I had hoped. And the sad reality is with the weakening of unions and the attacks on workers, the balance is thrown way off. And why do you think we have this mass inequality? It all goes back to Uncle Milty. It all goes back to this conservative theory. And these weren't conservatives, really. These were people who were radicals. Conservatives believe in institution. They believe in tradition. These people believe in, well, let's destroy and steal for ourselves. And I look at this and I go, you know, when will we learn? I mean, because look at the big banks. What collapsed our economy? Do you remember 2008? Do you remember the panic in September where we were forced to give, what was it, $750 billion written on two pages? No strings attached, nothing really to hold anyone accountable, just basically the banks putting a gun to our head saying, give us the money or the economy goes. That's how it was, if you remember. We were really, at that time, we were looking at depression. They were talking about our country going into a depression, the financial markets completely collapsing, and the gears of our economy grinding to a halt. And globally, in a lot of places, it did. We used to understand, and we used to, you know, before they screwed up the history of Thomas Jefferson, Jefferson believed that, you know, markets would regulate itself, but everybody was a farmer. Or everyone was a small business owner. There are no small business owners anymore, really. Everybody's growing to these being gobbled up. And What's interesting to me, and you know, as I said earlier in the first hour, you know, the woman who stole $15,000 is going to go to jail. The billionaire hedge fund manager who took $113 million, slap on the wrist. You got to pay $18 million back. The Bank of Liechtenstein, who did, oh, we are sorry, here's a little money. Oh, we won't do it again, promise. Pinky swear. Tell me where the justice is. Tell me where the sanity is. Look, I'm as pro-business as anyone. But I believe the way things used to be. This idea that we don't hold these huge conglomerates accountable and that we give them so much power, so much control. We can't pass a law anymore without the approval of special interests. The minority hath ruleth the roost. So what's it going to take? Is it possible, do you think, that we would ever see another Teddy Roosevelt, another trust buster, another person to come in and break up the monopoly? Because our banks are a monopoly. Oh, but there's a couple of them, Rick, so they're not really a monopoly. They're a monopoly. We've allowed, and this is why I think education is so important. We have been drumbeat. We have been drilled. We have been propagated to. We have had this message in our ears for 40 years now. And now we've bought it. I mean, we've really bought it. Hook, line, sinker, the whole nine yards. Chicago School won. Do we need to be much more business friendly? I sure hope not, man, because I don't know how much more you can get. And I look at this Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement that's coming up, and you look at the other ones that are in the pipeline that, from all indications, are going to be worse than the ones we've already saddled ourselves with. What's that going to mean to the middle class of this country? Well, it means it's going to go away. What's it going to mean to the working people of this country? And you may think, well, right now I'm okay. Right now. Ask those guys who thought that before NAFTA, who are working in the auto plants, who are working in the auto feeder plants, who are working in manufacturing, who were, you know, ask those people. Ask those people who their jobs went south to Mexico and then east to China. Ask them if everything's okay. Because we're about ready to go through it again. And all for, in my view, one reason. To consolidate power for the financial institutions. Now, the Bank of Liechtenstein using a New York law firm? Really? You got to wonder what kind of special interests were involved in that kind of a deal. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
AFSCME, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits, BBS Benefit Solutions, can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU, financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance a car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website, RickSmithShow.com. So it was today back in 1998, and I distinctly remember when Clinton ordered the cruise missile attacks in Afghanistan and Sudan in response to the attacks on embassies in Nairobi, Kenya, and in Tanzania. If you remember that, about 258 people were killed, a couple thousand more were injured. But you know what I really remember about that? I remember then Republican, soon to be turned Democratic senator from Pennsylvania, Arlen Specter, saying that, along with a number of others in Congress, saying that the whole thing and going after bin Laden and after the terrorists there in 98, it was because of Monica Lewinsky. It's diversion. It's a diversion tactic. If I remember, wag the dog, if I remember that being the phrase they used to use. Anyway, let's find out what's going on in Washington and around the world. I got Jeff Holtzman, Talk Radio News Service. Jeff, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me. No cruise missiles today, but there is obviously a lot of discussion focused on what's happening in Egypt because the question is, whether Washington will suspend its economic assistance to Egypt in light of what's happened with the overthrow of the Morsi regime and political turmoil continuing to happen and hundreds of deaths and ongoing violence. There was a report yesterday in the Daily Beast that cited a spokesman for Senator Pat Leahy who said that the White House had told him that it was cutting off its aid and that it had decided that, you know, what happened in Egypt was in fact a coup and therefore under the law it had no choice but to, you know, remove its economic assistance, which is around $1.3 billion a year. But the White House today, Rick, denied that report. A spokesman for the president said that the White House is reviewing its aid, but there has been no decision on whether to cancel it. To date, there is roughly $585 million in the State Department's budget that's been allocated toward foreign aid for Egypt that hasn't been spent yet, which is also surprising if you consider the fact that we're almost at the end of the fiscal year.
Yeah.
But that's essentially the money that Leahy's spokesman said is being canceled, but the White House says it's still on the table. And the president today convened a meeting with his cabinet to discuss the way forward. We haven't gotten a readout from that meeting or any sort of announcement to signal which way the White House is leaning. But I think that, they're privately, I think at least they believe that it was not a coup in Egypt. Otherwise, I don't see what the justification would be. And I think that publicly they've been sort of very noncommittal about whether or not it was a coup. But I think it would probably be wise for them to say that it was.
Yeah, absolutely, because my view is it was, but I understand that you still want to be a player in the game, and if you take the money out of it, I think that then you lose a bargaining chip on some level.
Yeah, you do, kind of. Then you sort of committed yourself, and we're not at the end game yet. And so I think the White House feels as though it's not time to commit yet because, you know, the chips have not all fallen. You still have a very precarious situation in that country. With the military, you know, clinging to power, but at the same time faced with the prospects of everyday violence, everyday protests, and that sort of thing. So I think the White House wants to see, you know, some stability a small sign of stability, at least, before it commits one way or the other with this money.
You know, over the weekend, there were hundreds of deaths, hundreds of people killed. Have things calmed down any? I mean, I haven't been following it as closely as I'm sure you have. Have things calmed down on any level?
Well, I think that today was a relatively quiet day there. Obviously, over the weekend, it was not. There have been some 900-odd deaths there in the last several weeks. I mean, that's just shocking. And so I think that you really need to see a longer pattern than just a day or two, you know, of relative quiet before you can make a determination.
Yeah, I hear a lot of people saying we should be cutting the aid. I'm not so sure. I guess I'm a little leery about drawing that line in the sand at this point.
Well, I think that it's probably too early to say that. And keep in mind also that, you know, foreign aid, this is something that the president has talked about before, and I think he's actually right when he makes the point that foreign aid is always, year after year, one of the most unpopular aspects of the United States federal budget.
Yeah.
But
and it's such a small part of it, too, though.
But it's a small part of the budget, make no mistake. And we're talking about $1 billion here. You've got the military funded at a $650 billion clip annually. So it's a drop in the bucket. And also, the interesting thing is, Rick, is even if the U.S. does pull or withdraw the rest of its aid for this year, you've got other countries in that region, Saudi Arabia, for instance, which has pledged to give Egypt 10 times that amount if Egypt needs more money. Kind of interesting. And Egypt's in a very, you know, dangerous financial situation. Their cash reserves are something like $13 or $14 billion.
Wow.
I mean, that's literally all the money that they're playing with over there. So, you know, they're obviously, you know, we need them obviously as a strategic partner in that region, but they need us. But I guess if, you know, they were to lose us, they could, you know, perhaps fill that economic assistance elsewhere.
Scary stuff. Look at the whole geopolitical wranglings of this. And, you know, again, you've got the knee-jerk reaction, which I try never to do, is pull all the money out of there, screw them, let them go off on their own. But if you let them devolve into chaos, that whole region goes with it, I think.
Yeah, well, we don't want to lose that strategic partner. I mean, Egypt is still an ally of the U.S. And, you know, it's just, there's so many, you mentioned the geopolitics. I mean, it's very, very complicated stuff there, but, you know, it's just really sort of, I think, a domino effect. You know, if you pull out and if the U.S. decides to, you know, take on an isolationist posture, with regard to Egypt, then who's to say that the U.S. shouldn't do the same thing, you know, with regard to Syria or, Bahrain, any of those countries that, experienced the Arab Spring. And then of course the administration would get criticized. Well, you know, you abandon Egypt, why not abandon these other countries? So it's sort of a, you know, pick your poison.
No, it's a no-win situation no matter what it is you do. I understand the president's going to be, on Friday talking about college affordability. I guess coming here to Scranton area.
Yeah, he'll be in your state, Rick, on Friday. He's doing a bus tour, leaving the White House on Thursday. He'll be in New York. Making a couple trips, and then he'll be in Scranton with Joe Biden on Friday. He'll be talking about college affordability. I don't know exactly what the president's plan or proposal will be when he speaks about it. Recently, whenever the president has talked about education, specifically higher education, it's been in the context of student loan interest rates. But Congress was able to come together before the August recess and pass a fix to keep the loan rate low.
Is that what they did? They kept the rate low.
Lowered it. They lowered it from where it was.
Right, where it was going. You're right.
They tethered it to the market. So of course those rates could rise in the future. Make no mistake.
Yeah, they're going to rise, all right. And my favorite part of that is with if I decide I'm going to pay for my kids' college, which I'm inevitably going to do, and I have to borrow money, I pay a considerably higher rate than they do, which makes no sense to me.
Yeah, the rates that families taking out loans would pay is higher than the rates that the graduate students or undergraduate students themselves would. And those rates ultimately would be capped, but you'd be near 11% when it's all said and done.
Yep.
It's a pretty high rate. I've seen different forecasts about what interest rates are going to do. They've been creeping up slowly in the last month or two, at least on housing rates, I know, and they hit, I mean, they bottomed out you know, at the beginning of the year. So I don't know how much lower they can get. So it's safe to say that those student loan rates are going to get higher in the years to come,
yep.
Which, of course, is more revenue for the government.
So what do you think he's going to say? I mean, here in this state, we talked to a guy running for Congress, Brandon Boyle, a state representative, who's proposing an idea, much like Oregon's Pay It Forward. Will we hear something very progressive out of the president, something visionary, or will we see more tinkering around the edges?
I would expect to hear something more idealistic from the president and less, you know, pragmatic, because, you know, I think the president has sort of, you know, gone down this road before with these speeches he's given, you know, to put out some ideas that he thought could attract bipartisan support, and of course not much has gotten through Congress. So I think at this point, I think it behooves him to really go for broke and lay out his core philosophical vision for how to lower college tuition prices. I mean, you know, the bottom line is something needs to be done. It's not just private institutions that are raising prices. It's public institutions as well that are getting extremely expensive. And seemingly there are no incentives on a federal level for colleges to really cut their costs.
Yeah,
so
well, I mean, the other part of that is that the states are, and really the federal government has been walking away from funding education. Here in the state of Pennsylvania, the state-owned universities, back in the 80s, the state used to pick up about two-thirds of the cost of tuition, and the student picked up a third. Today, that number is three-quarters of the cost of tuition is borne by the student and only a quarter by the state. We've seen a massive redistribution of wealth, a complete flip-flop on this, where, you know, now it's the student who's footing the bill, as were in the past. It was taxpayers who put the money in because it was an investment in the future.
Right. Well, and I think that is going to be part of what the president's going to call for. You know, again, I don't have any specifics, but I would imagine that would be, you know, part and parcel of his proposal.
I hope so.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be really surprised if it wasn't. And I think that, you know, I mean, you hear a lot of talk in Congress about the fact that education is, you know, really, you know, sort of a windfall type investment, but there hasn't been a lot of action. And so I think that, you know, the president has decided, the White House has decided that they have to sort of get the ball rolling on this because, you know, Congress is going to get distracted with other things like the debt ceiling, and they're going to lose sight of this. And so I think it's contingent upon the president to really make this an issue as we head into the fall.
Yeah, or as the, you know, the chest thumpers like to say, go big or go home.
So there you go.
I'm hoping something big comes out of it. I understand today the president invited the 1972 Dolphins to the White House. I guess my first question is, why? Why?
Well, that's a good question because, you know, I mean, there's seemingly no real milestone. I mean, technically, yeah, they won the Super Bowl, they went undefeated, and they finished in 1973, so it's been 40 years. So that's sort of a, you know, milestone, but I think the president said himself today at the ceremony, you know, this is, you know, a lot of people have asked why do this, and he said, because it's fun. I like doing it.
Yeah, okay. if that's it, then great. You know, all the power to you, photo ops you hang on your wall. I'm not against it. Give somebody a job. I understand a couple of the big names of the 72 Dolphins decided for pure political reasons they weren't going to attend.
Yeah, there were three players, including Jim Langer, who's in the Hall of Fame, who's an offensive lineman on that team.
He's the center.
And he was the center on that team, and that's right. And all three of them, you know, essentially said that they disagreed with the president's politics. One of them, an offensive tackle on the team, said that he doesn't belong at the White House, which is kind of an unusual statement. I mean, the bottom line is these players on these teams that get invited, they all have the right to not attend.
Sure.
But it makes a big headline when they don't because it's so rare. I mean, the president does several of these, you know, championship ceremonies every single year. In fact, he just honored the UConn women's basketball game a couple weeks ago. So this is a pretty common occurrence, and it's very rare for these players and these former players to not go. I look at it like, hey, you know, it doesn't really matter who's in office. It's sort of an honor to go to the White House,
yep,
and honored by the White House. But, you know, that's just me.
No, I feel the same way. I mean, you know, had as much as I disliked both the Bushes, had they invited me to the White House, I would have, in honor of the position more than anything.
Right.
I would have attended. I mean, you don't snub your nose at that. But, you know, hey, like they said, this is a free country. Do what you want. I think it bodes poorly on the team as a whole. I don't think the president cares one way or another. But I think it's kind of a – if I were on the team, I would be kind of upset about it because you want to have all of your teammates there, I think. Just my thought.
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, take part in such a – you know, such a big honorable ceremony like that, you want your whole team to be there. You did it with them, and it's you know, it's a shame that they couldn't all do it. But I think that the best part of today was Don Shula had a pretty good line. Don Shula coached that team, and he was there today, and he pointed out that the president's favorite team is the Bears, obviously, and the only team to beat the Bears in their 85 Super Bowl season was the Miami Dolphins. That got a good shot.
Well, you get a little shot where you can, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Not a big fan of the Bears myself. Good for – I didn't even know Shula was still alive. Good for him. Senator Lamar Alexander said compromise and bipartisanship isn't all that bad. Did he really say that?
Well, essentially. I mean, this is kind of an interesting op-ed. So there are a couple Tea Party groups in Tennessee that are – beginning to mount a challenge to Lamar Alexander. He's up for re-election next year. Of course, he's a Republican, but in the eyes of the Tea Party, he's, you know, part of the establishment of the GOP. And they've accused him of, you know, compromising with Democrats and, you know, working with other establishment Republicans like John McCain and so on and so forth. Lamar Alexander wrote a really interesting op-ed in one of the local papers in Tennessee today in which he said, you know what? This is basic math. You have 45 Republicans. If you want to pass anything, you need 60 votes. Therefore, you have to, you know, work with others, whether they're in the Republican Party or Democratic Party. It doesn't really matter. You just need the math to work. That was one of the reasons he gave behind him, you know, looking for compromise and looking for bipartisanship. You know, I think he makes some really good points in this op-ed, and it would be interesting to see if the, you know, the Tea Party challenges to him sort of die down, or if this, you know, causes them to, you know, if this ignites more of a fire for them and they actually do mount a contest against him. But, you know, it was kind of interesting to see.
Yeah, I'm thinking you'll see a challenge. And, you know, to me, I think he's one of the guys who could be fairly vulnerable, from the right, not so much from Democrats, but from the right. But I found interesting as I saw a report that Scalia was given a speech in Montana and talking about Congress and the idea of a tyrannical president. And he said something along the line that it's garbage and that if Congress holds the real power. And this is something I think the Tea Party forgets here. Congress really, the president's just kind of a figurehead, really. I mean, he doesn't have any real power to, I keep hearing all this, wow, he's making all these regulations. He's doing all this stuff. Not without Congress, he's not.
Yeah, no, for the most part, I mean, I think that's a really interesting point, is that, you know, Congress does wield the majority of the power. I mean, the president has the ability, you know, to sort of, you know, to do some things here and there. He can act executively, but he can't do anything huge via executive action. He can't pass a budget via executive action. He can't raise taxes via executive action. There are only certain things that he can do. And this goes for, you know, Republican and Democratic administrations. I mean, you know, you pretty much are at the, you know, at the will of Congress. And perhaps that's one of the reasons that Congress's approval rating is so low. We're talking about in the 10 or 15% range. Because there, you know, are a fair amount of people who do understand that Congress does hold the keys and that they haven't been able to do much. But, I mean, I think that Scalia's comments were pretty interesting, almost a defense of President Obama from somebody who you wouldn't expect to make that defense.
Yeah, he did say something about the Second Amendment that caught my attention, something along the lines of they haven't really determined yet what the scope of people's right to keep and bear arms is. You know, can they have rocket launchers? Said that something along the his approach would be a historical one. You know, because, you know, people should be able to protect themselves from the tyrannical leader.
Yeah, I saw that statement that he made, and I think, yeah, exactly. What he's saying is, you know, his interpretation is you know, to protect from tyranny, to protect from government, but at the same time drawing the line between, you know, reasonable and owning an RPG, you know, I guess is sort of refreshing to see that. You know, Scalia doesn't think you should be able to own an RPG.
Well, at least I hope he doesn't anyway. And finally, what are your thoughts of Ted Cruz renouncing his Canadian citizenship?
You know, I saw that, and first off, I did not know that he had dual citizenship.
I didn't either.
I guess he didn't either. Well, at least that's what he's saying. And I see that it might take him 8 months to actually relinquish his citizenship. But I think if he's really serious about doing it, then to me that points to a possible 2016 run. I mean, I don't see any other I don't see any other reason to do it, to make an issue out of it, other than the fact that that's what he's doing, positioning himself.
And I hope he does, because I think it'll answer that question that, you know, that McCain, I thought, would have answered had he, well, fortunately, he didn't become president, but had he become president, you know, someone being a natural-born citizen, which, you know, many interpret as, you know, born on American soil here in the U.S., maybe not so much overseas, or in Cruz's case, in Canada. So I think it'd be an interesting, it'll be interesting to see.
I mean, I think it's whatever happens, it's going to be a really interesting Republican field in 2016. You're going to have probably Cruz on the far right. You're going to have Rand Paul, who's, you know, sort of a hybrid between somebody on the far right and more of a libertarian. You're going to have Marco Rubio, who I think by 2016 will be fully embraced as, or fully branded, I should say, as an establishment candidate. And then you're going to have Chris Christie, who, you know, they're already calling an establishment candidate, I guess because he's, you know, being courted by typical, you know, establishment donors and that sort of thing. But Christie is, you know, the most outsider there is of all four of those guys. I mean, he's not in Washington. He works in New Jersey. So that's what the really interesting thing is. And I think that, you know, these guys who are on paper more conservative than Christie are, you know, they're sort of building that narrative behind the scenes that Christie is the establishment candidate, when in fact, it's the guys in Washington who have been there for a couple of years now who are going to be more insiders than Chris Christie by the time 2016 rolls around.
Yeah, Christie's the one who scares me the most, because I think he's the one who could easily win, just based on my perception and the way I see folks in New Jersey, how people have kind of gravitated towards him in a Democratic-leaning state.
Well, yeah, I mean, if it comes down to a large swath of independent voters, you know, if enough Democrats become swing voters, then yeah, Chris Christie poses an enormous possibility to win in 2016, because, you know, what his approval rating is, you know, he's getting near, you know, 70% in New Jersey. I mean, it's insane in a blue state. So if he can, you know, and again, New Jersey doesn't necessarily represent the model for the entire country, but, you know, if it does to a certain degree, then he's going to be formidable. Of course, Hillary Clinton is going to be very formidable on the Democratic side. My original pick 2 years ago, I thought David Petraeus was going to run for the nomination. I thought that he had the experience. I thought that he had, you know, obviously the military.
Good call, pedigree.
And then that whole thing blew up in my face. So I'm going to try not to make any more predictions.
There you go. Well, please predict that Christie's going to be the guy.
I can't at this point. I just, I've made a vow.
Maybe we'll find him with what's that saying? A dead hooker or a live boy?
Yeah, well, I think it'll probably even wear like a cheesesteak, but.
No, not since he had the gastric banding. I don't think he could hold a whole cheesesteak.
Man, well, if he had that, yeah, I hope he's laying off those.
There you go.
They're addictive.
Anyway, Jeff Holtzman, I appreciate the time, buddy.
All right, Rick, thanks.
Thanks so much, Jeff Holtzman, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Together we will live on forevermore. Now we've defended from all things that are good. Now we are defenseless.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing, to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began the first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized a renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. So, Larry Summers, Fed chair, maybe not. Senator Pat Roberts, Republican from Kansas, evidently told the Kansas Independent Oil and Gas Association that he didn't want Larry Summers. He said he wouldn't let, and this is one of those things you go, wow, pretty strong statement. He wouldn't let the Larry Summers mow his yard, and that Vice Chair Janet Yellen is more qualified. Not that he's thrilled with her, but that she's at least more qualified. And, you know, I got to be honest, I have found something that I agree with Pat Roberts on. It's rare, but, you know, hey, this should be interesting. Now, it's not like he's going to be putting a yard sign out in front of his house for Yellen, but at least there's a growing sense of, please, not Larry Summers. No, please, not him. Just bad decision after bad decision. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Always love input. Something I said got under your skin. Something you liked, something you didn't. You can email me, Rick@therickSmithShow.com. Remember, tomorrow, at noon over at the Capitol Rotunda, they're going to have the little anti-gun demonstration. Really, I guess the background check demonstration, because I think he was looking more for background checks and some rational sanity than anything else. I hope folks will get out to that. Have a good one. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming.